Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
UFC 274 coming up this weekend. You've got the lightweight belt on the line in the main event. Charles Oliveira taking on Justin Gaethje. And listen, in that co-main event, Rose Namajunas, Carlos Esparza, a rematch 2,703 days in the making since they fought for that inaugural belt at the Ultimate Fighter 20 finale. All of a sudden, you have a giant card shaping up for this weekend. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, as always, Matt Allen on the respective socials. Now, Matt Allen FNP, when we do look back at last weekend, we had question mark kicks. We had a big time week of fights with Font and Vera. And ultimately, if you found me on the socials at Craig Allen FNP, I was quite salty about the fact that, listen, Nathan Levy, Jake Collier, my question mark kicks parlay, it was taken away from me on the fact that Collier was not able to get the win. But I have this week to look forward to. And listen, when we have a card that's loaded like this, 15 total fights, but very, very top heavy, I know you can rally around it and get excited here.
I disagree with the top heavy comment. I feel like this card top to bottom is going to be an absolute banger. It's one of the more fun cards of the year because I knew we were going to bring up what the average age is on the main card. These are fighters that we not only know, we've kind of grown up with throughout the years, like Cowboy Cerrone, Shogun Hua, Tony Ferguson. These are fighters who have kind of defined like the last 5-6 years of MMA. And that's why I'm so excited for this card. You've got a little bit of new, a little bit old, but a ton of great fights up and down this whole entire card. And I feel like there are a few fights that are definitely flying under the radar just because of how good these top two title fights are. Justin Gaethje versus Charles Oliveira isn't just two of the best lightweights in the world. These are two of the best pound-for-pound fighters in mixed martial arts fighting each other in their primes. I am as excited for this pay-per-view as I have been for any this year.
A lot of people just take it on faith that Justin Gaethje fights like if Homer Simpson still had the crayon lodged in his brain, but he really does bring more than that to the octagon. Ferguson Chandler, OSP, Shogun Hua, another fight that's 2,700 days plus in the remaking. And then you also have Cerrone, Lozon to round out that main card. But a lot of prospects and fights that we're eager to talk about on the prelims. And as you know, with Fight Night Picks, we throw it on up to the fight of the night screen. We want to hear from you down below in the comments section because, listen, pretty cut and dry between the two of us. Not much in terms of disagreement. So we'll throw it on over to the fight of the night screen.
Let us know down below in the comments section who you've got. It's time for the fight of the night with Fight Night Picks.
And listen, for Michael Chandler, came into the UFC with a full head of steam, three-time Bellator lightweight champ, knocks out Dan Hooker in his debut, loses Charles Oliveira for the belt, and listen, I mean, takes that as water off duck's back because then he has a fight of the year against Justin Gaethje, comes out on the losing end there. So for Chandler, he's on a two-fight losing streak. For Tony Ferguson, he's on a three-fight losing streak. But you know that a guy who formerly had a 12-fight win streak in Tony Ferguson, who does not know boring fights when he brings a snap-jitsu mentality into fight week, this should be an amazing matchup. And if we got this 5 years ago, I probably would have gone through the ceiling with excitement.
This fight 5 years ago would have been insane. But even today, it's going to be an incredible fight because these are two fighters who represent the theory of records are for DJs. You can't just look at a person's record and think, oh, wow, they're not that good and I don't want to watch them anymore. Tony Ferguson has lost to three of the best lightweights of our generation as of late, but I still feel like he has some tread left on the tires to put a great performance on against a guy like Michael Chandler, who is in a bit of an interesting spot of his career because he's accomplished so much, and then he came to the UFC, and he's had nothing but incredible fights ever since, so I don't think this matchup against Tony Ferguson is going to be any different. I think this fight should be 5 rounds. I know we'll probably talk about that more later, but Chandler versus Ferguson, they're both great on the feet. They're both great grapplers. It should be a phenomenal fight.
Nick Diaz versus Robbie Lawler was 5 rounds, and this is not... I need it! Come on! And listen, at Fight Night Picks, we've been of the mentality since we kicked off in 2018 that flyweight should never die. I mean, Jared Brooks would probably be a top-ranked UFC flyweight if he was allowed to continue with the promotion, but... Having said that, we still have Brandon Royval matched now, and these two guys don't know boring fights, and somewhere atop a mountain will be Rogerio Bontorin, just looking, watching, waiting, kind of like the Grinch, but he's looking to steal, like, the thunder from these two guys. And listen, We're going to talk about that one a lot as we move forward. But these two guys are killer be killed flyweights and very, very dynamic at that. I absolutely love this booking here between Royval and Chanel.
It should be a phenomenal fight because these are two guys. You don't worry about them on the feet. They're both very good strikers. They're both phenomenal grapplers, and they've demonstrated that on many different occasions. And that phenomenal cardio, too. This isn't one of those fights where it's like, okay, it might be great for 7 minutes, and then it's going to fall off a cliff. This fight's going to be phenomenal for the first minute to the last one because both guys are proven finishers, and they're both extremely offensively oriented. So it's probably going to result in a finish one way or the other, and I think it's going to be a great fight.
Hey, let us know down below in the comments section who you have on paper to be that fight of the night. Last weekend, we cherry-picked. We went with the main event. And lo and behold, that ended up as the fight of the night. But some amazing ones last weekend. Gabe Green's coming back against the old Johan Lainez. We had some amazing fights. And again, you folks drive the show. So let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this fight of the night screen. So ultimately, if you look at just the main card, you have Oliveira Gaethje, lightweight champ, former interim lightweight champion Gaethje. Your co-main event, Namajunas is the champ, Esparza, inaugural champ. Then you have Michael Chandler, former title challenger, against former interim champ Tony Ferguson. Ovince St. Preux, former title challenger, against former light heavyweight champ Mauricio Shogun Hua. And to kick off the main card, former title challenger Cowboy Oliveira, tied for number one all time with UFC performance bonuses. Tied number one all time, of course, with one half of your main event, Charles Oliveira, taking on Joe Lauzon, who is right up near the top of bonus money when it comes to overall UFC standings. So an amazing main card. You can check that out on the Fight Night Picks Sidekick. That one's going to be live during the main card here on our YouTube channel. So if you're not subscribed, well, it takes 2 seconds. And then, you know, when we go live, you can hang out. You folks drive that chat. And you always do 2 hours before the prelims because, Matt, what happens then on Saturdays?
We have a great little show known as Question Mark Kicks. It just gives us one last chance to go up and down the card. If there are any big weight misses, any injuries throughout the week, or any little, you know, tidbits we'd like to focus on right before we give our main predictions, well, that's the show that we like to do it on. But before I give it back to you, Craig, since it's a pay-per-view, what else do we do Saturday night?
We have the sidekick. I mentioned it. The sidekick. During the main card. The sidekick. Check it out. But ultimately, no. I mean, when we look at this card, we have so many big-time fighters, so many fighters that have main evented different cards. Obviously, even Norma Dumont's coming off a main event slot.
I was about to say, how good is this card? We have a non-title, non-main event women's featherweight bout. That's one of the rarest things you'll ever see in your whole entire life.
And it happened. And then, yeah, we end up with this one coming up this weekend. Three different debuts. The debut of Fernie Garcia, of Cledson Rodriguez, and a late notice addition to this card because there's no subtractions, but you have Andrea Fialho taking on the UFC newcomer Cameron Van Camp. So 15 total fights right now, a lot of action to get into. So without further ado, let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend at welterweight. We have the debut of Indiana's own former B2 Fighting Series welterweight champ, Cameron Van Camp. And he's going to be taking on a tough test in Sanford MMA's Andrea Fialho. And listen, Fialho is one of those guys that, if he's not a household name just yet, maybe in South Florida and in parts of Portugal, realistically all of Portugal. But if you look at it for Fialho, two quick fights in the UFC. One against Michel Pereira at the UFC 270 main card. And listen, he was taking on a really tough test and a guy that's somewhere in between the top 25 of the UFC's welterweight division in Michel Pereira. Competitive fight there. Only earned $12,000 for that fight. And then all of a sudden, he's taking on Miguel Baeza as a hefty little bit of an underdog. And in that fight, giant knockout. And that one wasn't all that long ago. So on April 17th, late into the night of Fialho's fight against Baeza, Spinning Backfist sent out a tweet saying that Fialho had been kind of talking to Dana White saying he wanted to get on the UFC 274 card. Ultimately, April 30th, the tweet goes out there that he's going to get an opponent, and it is Cameron Van Camp. So this one on relatively short notice for Fialho. His last fight was just about 2 weeks ago, so it really is a short notice opportunity for both of these men. And for Cameron Van Camp, he was supposed to make his UFC debut last fall against Nicholas Motta, moving down to 155 pounds. And we'll talk about Van Camp's weight because throughout his career, he spent the majority of his time at welterweight, some pit stops at 155 pounds.
No idea how he makes that weight, by the way.
No, he started his career, also has one fight on his record at featherweight, so that's kind of wild, too.
Because he's big.
Yeah, he's a giant guy, even for welterweight, but a big opportunity for Van Camp. And even as recently as March, if you ever follow that UFC roster watch on Twitter, out was Cameron Van Camp. So I thought maybe he'd get an opportunity to kind of ply his trade back on the regional scene again, because he has a good level of competition on that record. Most of them are losses. All of them are losses. But still, he's fought some decent names. Like, he has a fight against Austin Hubbard at lightweight. Lost that one by finish. He has a no contest on his record against Thomas Gifford. Well, Gifford submitted him by guillotine in the first minute of that fight, but listen, failed drug test. And then he fought Bobby Volker in a 5-round fight for the Shamrock title, and he was unsuccessful in that one. So, Matt, for Cameron Van Camp, a guy that's definitely not as well-known as Fialho, because this is a guy that used to be co-main eventing Bellator shows against Chitty Bang Bang and Joe Kiani. But when it comes into this one this weekend, honest to goodness, the deck is kind of stacked against Cameron Van Camp.
It really is. And I'm really happy that the UFC did grant Andre Fialho his wish, because the second he knocked out Miguel Baeza, what was the first thing he said in the mic? Give me more fights. I'm ready whenever. He didn't have a specific name, which I'm not a fan of. I gotta be honest, I like it when a fighter gives a name. Make the UFC's job easier than it has to be, and then they'll probably give you that matchup. But I did like how active he wanted to be. I do worry, though, with his fighting style, it's probably not the type of style you want the guy being in there every month, every 2 months with, because that's the thing about his fight with Baeza. Was the finish beautiful? Yes, it was. He brutalized him with uppercuts in the clinch, and that wasn't a position I thought he was going to have a lot of success with, to be completely honest with you. So it was really nice to see from Andre Fialho. But you had brought up the stats really quick right before this, and it is a little bit telling that he did eat 24 significant strikes in the early part of that fight. The finish was very nice, but I do worry about Fialho when he does start to fight those upper echelon strikers. And I'm talking about more guys like Jeff Neal, guys in that category who are near the rankings, because what they're going to do is they're going to wait for you to throw your flurries, they're going to find the openings in your flurries, and then they're going to counter really hard down the middle. And I do worry about Fialho when he does start to fight some of those upper echelon guys, because he has shown the susceptibility to getting hit on the feet. Now, he has one of the greatest Uno reverse cards of all time, and it's, hey, if we're in 50-50 exchanges right now, well, my punches are going to hurt a lot worse than your punches are going to hurt, so my damage is going to be able to accumulate over time. But I will be curious when or if Fialho, let's say, gets someone like a Daniel Rodriguez, someone who's outside of the rankings, but we respect them almost like they are a ranked fighter. I think that would be a phenomenal fight if he is able to get past Cameron Van Camp. But this is a weird, weird fight, because I agree with you 100%. For Fialho, to say he could get into the rankings right now, it's a bit of a stretch, but he has accepted two fights that most guys in the first two UFC fights would not accept. If you're accepting a fight against Michelle Pereira and Miguel Baeza, you must think quite highly of your own skills. And I like what you mentioned about him being able to fight in large shows in Bellator. He was not some guy who just showed up and we didn't know who Fialho is. He has some good wins on his record. He has a few losses on his record, but they're two recognizable names. And I guess that's the thing I want to say for both guys. I'm glad you brought it up for Cameron Van Camp. His record might not look great as a guy just coming into the UFC, but the one good thing about his record is the losses are to people who we know. They're not to fighters who are 8-6 and they just sort of went off into the ether afterwards. They're recognizable names, like you had said, Austin Hubbard, Bobby Volker. I know he fought Robbie Lawler all the way back in the day and got head kicked by him, but still, these are names that are recognizable if you've been paying attention to the sport for long enough. So it's not like Cameron Van Camp can just get beat by any guy who has a decent record on the regional scene. But fighting Andre Fialho on full notice, I think, would have been really tough. Now you're accepting this fight on short notice. Like, Fialho just came off of a camp in a fight where he didn't take a ton of damage, although he got hit more than I would have liked to. So he's still probably in fighting shape, getting ready for this fight.
Yeah, the weirdest part about this one, and if you want a 6 degrees Kevin Bacon this weekend with Robbie Lawler, you've got Bobby Volker, who fought against Cameron Van Camp. Volker loses to Robbie Lawler. CJ Vergara's coach is Pete Sell. Pete Sell beat Robbie Lawler, so it's kind of crazy that way. But when we do look at this fight for Fialho, technical boxing, good when he uses leg kicks, but he doesn't do it very often. And the best weapon in his arsenal is his left hook. And you saw that against James Vick in that fight. But realistically, Baez is one of those guys, kind of like an Ovince St. Preux, where Baez is always pressuring forward. Ovince St. Preux is always on the back foot. It's just when those two guys figure out the distance, that's when they really look amazing. And for Ovince, once he can time you when you're coming in, he can knock you out. Once Baez can figure out, once Fialho can figure out, okay, I have my openings when I'm pushing forward. You're not prodding your jab out there. You're not throwing kicks forward. I'm able to really go in there and do a lot of damage. That's when you see Fialho winning these fights. The great win streak that he had 4 in a row before he made his UFC debut. He was able to do that to great effect. And even before that, you look at some of the losses. Antonio Dos Santos Jr., the loss to Glyco França over with PFL. It was a loss on his record, overturned to a no contest because França was on the sauce. And then the loss to Chris Curtis, where it was the takedown defense and a bit of the accumulation that kind of one out for, I guess, Curtis in the fight against Fialho. For Cameron Van Camp, though, we haven't really talked about him stylistically. This is a guy that can get it done in a lot of different ways. He likes to switch his stances. He'll start out in southpaw, pump the jab out there. He switches over to orthodox, starts to throw his kicks. And he really likes to mix in his takedowns, but they're not the traditional, like, he's not going in there, double leg, taking his time. A lot of body lock takedowns, a lot of trip takedowns. He is a different fighter and a tricky guy to figure out. And once Cameron Van Camp has that going for him, he can really start to roll in some of these fights.
And that's the thing. I think if Van Camp just completely smothers Fialho, he can have a lot of success, even on the feet in this fight. Because the thing is, if you're not letting him throw, you're not taking any damage yourself. And the thing about Van Camp, he does have fairly good cardio. He just has weird cardio, where sometimes he will be doing a lot. He'll be doing kind of unnecessary movement, if we are being honest, from the outside, because he'll switch stances, but sometimes he'll switch, not really throw anything, switch back, not really throw anything. You'd like to see a little bit more activity out of those stance switches, because while it's fresh in your opponent's memory, you're not really giving them time to set and figure out where exactly you are. If Van Camp does do that on the outside, if he's doing a bunch of wasted movement, this is going to be an awful fight for him, because if Fialho can start to chop down those legs, eliminate some of that movement, you're going to get rid of some of the explosion in his own takedown attempts, Van Camp eventually will become a sitting duck on the feet, and that is the big thing about him. You brought it up earlier with his multiple weight classes he has spanned throughout his career. He's a guy who has made 145 and 155 in the past. Now, I don't think you can look at Cameron Van Camp and tell me honestly you think he could make 145 pounds. At this stage of his life, he has built up quite a bit. But I do feel like with his punching power, he's going to be at a decided disadvantage in this matchup. And I do think he's going to play the striking game probably a little bit too much early on. This is what I will say about Fialho. He's almost like, it's like betting on a pie chart that has like 60% wins by knockout. And the other 40%, I do worry about him fighting some of the more crisp strikers. I think offensively, he is phenomenal. But I do worry about him defensively when he does throw his own power shots. Again, I don't think this fight against Cameron Van Camp is going to be the one that cost him, but it will worry me going forward.
Van Camp can sometimes lead into his blitzes with his head wide open, right out there in front, really hittable that way. And when he strikes on the back foot, he tends to put his hands out and leave his head up, and it really is a bad combination.
It's interesting for a guy who's as tall as he is. Normally, you'd see them use the jab, try to use different techniques like that. Like, we're going to talk about Tony Ferguson later. Tony Ferguson's best move is his front kick to the body. I don't care what anyone says. His front kick to the body is ridiculous. Now, he hasn't used it as much his last couple fights, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but if Van Camp had more tools like that, I think it would help him a lot. But you're right. He does find himself reaching a lot four strikes, and it's weird to see for a guy who could weaponize his height so well.
Switches to orthodox and then ducks his head to the right every single time. Again, super short notice, but you duck to your right a lot, and Fialho's best strike is his left hook. That's a method to get knocked out. So we have a look at the votes on Tapology. This fight was just announced yesterday. There are no odds. I'm going to say over under 90% Fialho.
I would say, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. 261 total votes, 93% Fialho, 86% by knockout. For the 7% that have Van Camp, 47% by knockout, I've got Andrea Fialho in this fight 10 times out of 10. If Cameron Van Camp wins, I will be muy surprised.
If Van Camp's going to win, it will be with his grappling. Again, Fialho does have an Achilles heel, and it has been his wrestling defense in the past. Now, that's why I like how they've matched him up, to be honest. I like the last two guys. They've been sort of these action-style fights. I think this will probably end up becoming one of those fights. And if it does, it's going to be a tough one for Cameron Van Camp. I do like Fialho quite a bit.
Neither one of us going with Lebanon, Indiana's own. We're going with Portugal's own, Andrea Fialho, in this matchup. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have in a dynamic matchup at welterweight. And listen, big time title fights up at the top. Naomi Yunus aspires a number 2, and Charles Oliveira taking on Justin Gaethje. You're gonna want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it. time fight coming up this weekend at Bantamweight. Looking to set the table, looking to get fresh and get excited, we have the return of Jurny Newsom, who's taking on the UFC debuting Fernie Garcia, representing Fortis MMA. And in this fight, I say the returning Jurny Newsom because he's been out for a year and 7 months since his last fight, where he got knocked out quite badly against the Zohan, Randy Costa. And so you do look at it for Jurny Newsom. It's been an interesting run in the UFC. He makes his UFC debut on 12 days notice, replacing Bellator champion, I should say now former Bellator. No, he still is, because the interim champ is Ralphian Stott. So yes, current Bellator champion Sergio Pettis, who's supposed to take on Ricardo Hamosh. Out is Pettis. In steps Newsom. He ends up losing to Ricardo Hamosh. And in that fight, was it a striking defense that evaded him? No, it was actually his takedown defense. So kind of crazy in that one for Jurny Newsom, because realistically, at this point in his life, he's a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. He trains out of Impact Jiu-Jitsu. And he's a guy where you look at the way that he fights, then you look at his record, and it's just kind of crazy, because the guy that we've seen in his three UFC fights, a loss to Hamosh, a knockout win over Domingo Plarte, overturned to a no contest because of the green good giggles, and then a win. Well, no, it wasn't a win that he had against Randy Costa. It was a worse way to lose. It's been weird for Newsom. He's been off for over a year. You kind of try and listen to rumblings as to, like, why has Jurny Newsom been away? I try to do the background research for these things. So it seems like it was a knee injury. I see on his Instagram, he's been kind of getting some work in at the UFCPI, working with the psychiatrist there to get himself back into it, working through his knee woes. And then I tried to listen to a podcast that was an hour and 20 minutes long, with MMA roasted Adam Hunter. He also had, other than Jurny Newsom, he had, and I want to make sure that I get it right, Jasmine St. Clair. Jasmine St. Clair. She was in dirty movies in the 90s, and she also wrestled in ECW. So Adam Hunter, doing the damn thing. But for Newsom, didn't really touch on it. He's got an interesting test taking on Fernie Garcia, primarily known for his boxing, and a guy who's been a giant favorite in his time over with LFA. Fought a very interesting fight on Dana White's Contender Series, because he also zigged where he zagged, and he's not really a knockout puncher. Gets a first-round knockout win over with Dana White's Contender Series. So an interesting matchup we have coming up this weekend.
Fernie Garcia, you're right. Not really a knockout puncher. Really nice boxing technique, though, for an MMA fighter. Someone who will throw in combination, and I know you love this, goes to the body well with his combinations. Someone who... The best way of describing it is, and this is going to be a Teddy Atlasism, it's like mosquitoes on a windshield. He gives you a lot to think about up top, gets you to raise your hands, and then he'll go to the body, be it with knees. He's not a huge kicker. He will go knees to the body every now and then just because of the distance when he's boxing, but he will go to the body a lot with his hands. And this fight against Jurny Newsom, it's weird because you're right. Garcia, a big favorite in a lot of his fights, especially as of late. I thought going into this fight, he would be another very big favorite over Jurny Newsom, because the Jurny Newsom that I was promised when he came into the UFC is not the guy who we've got. And I know this sounds weird, but I had a fairly high hopes for him. I know this is always one of those things like, who's a fighter you thought would be really good who never really turned into the fighter you thought they were going to become? Jurny Newsom's kind of that guy for me. To me, he fights like Johnny Hendricks did at the later stage of his career. You're a wrestler, you can wrestle, you can grapple, but you fall in love too much with your own power. And it is like Jurny Newsom's bought into his own hype. He's someone who wings massive power shots in the feet. And if they land, yeah, they look great. Ask Domingo Plarte how it went. He hit him with one shot and absolutely destroyed him. But the problem is with Newsom, he doesn't have anything on the in-between. Anything inside those big flurries or those big explosions, he doesn't really throw a lot in combination. He's not much of a kicker. He has the wrestling in his back pocket, but it's not really something we've seen enough of at the UFC level. And that's why I wonder, what's Jurny Newsom going to do in this fight if the striking's not going well for him against Fernie Garcia? I think he has the wrestling advantage in this matchup, don't get me wrong. But Newsom's a guy who... He's a good wrestler, but it's almost like Yoel Romero. How many times did we see Yoel complete a takedown just for the person on the bottom to spring back up to their feet? It's weird. You would assume with his level of wrestling, he would also have a very high level of top control. But with Newsom, it does feel like the guys underneath can escape sometimes.
Well, and the weirdest part about it, so you look at Jurny, and he's known as a grappler, but if you watch his fights in the UFC, you wouldn't think this guy's a grappler. And again, with Fernie Garcia, you look at it, his last win was his first ever knockout, and his first round finish since what? In 3 years. So he's not necessarily known as a finisher. The thing that I like about Fernie Garcia is, again, lots of great flurries, mixes up his shots, really good shot selection, does not throw kicks. Like, Fernie Garcia does not kick. He's a boxer in MMA, and he's not much of a grappler either. So if I was to stack up the skills, which, listen, you go back and you watch Dana White's Contender Series, I always love it when they show those, the where they rank their stats. So they went with a 4 on his Fernie Garcia striking, a 4 on his wrestling, a 2.5 on his grappling, and a 2 on his experience. And again, I touched on the fact that Garcia was a big favorite in his 3 fights leading into the UFC. When he took on Hayes, he was a -950. Won that fight by split decision, but it was a chintzy split decision. 2 of the judges scored at 30-27. One had it 29-28 Hayes, which was an awful scorecard. Garcia definitely won that fight. Then he goes out in there against Batten Gonzalez. He is a -320 in that one. And then against Weems, he's a -250. He was also a favorite against the short notice replacement that he took on Dana White's Contender Series in Weems, who also missed weight in that fight. Weighed 139 for 135. So again, Fernie Garcia's got jiu-jitsu in his back pocket. He is a purple belt in his own right. Trains out of Fortis MMA with the likes of Damon Jackson. You see him on his Instagram. You also see Ocho Peterson in the corner of Fernie Garcia, laying down a lot of swear words. My favorite part about watching the LFA tape on Fernie Garcia is a Ron Crux Savage moment.
Reflection of this fight completely. Ron, I think you have a phone call, but
they know not to call me during a broadcast. It's the press box.
Ron Kruk probably never thought he was getting memed. Man got memed, but an awesome response to Pat Miletich. So I look at this fight, Matt, as Fernie Garcia is definitely the better boxer. Like, without a doubt, more crisp, more technical boxer. He can throw more at you. Newsom's obviously got the X factor, the power between these two guys.
But that's the thing about MMA. You don't get scored for defense, and people don't really care about volume if you're fighting a power puncher. I agree with everything you said, but the thing is, Jurnee Newsom can hit him 3 times in a round, and that can still make up for whatever Fernie Garcia was able to do before that, and that's what I worry about in this fight. I do think the numbers could favor Fernie Garcia at the end of the fight, but I do worry, what if he gets taken down 1 time in a round and he spends a minute off his back? What if he does get hit by one big shot? Because he doesn't have the real genuine finishing ability, and I do question his finishing ability at the UFC level too, because it's one thing to get split decisions on like LFA, it's another thing to go out there and get finished wins at the UFC level. I just worry about how can Garcia get back some of those big moments if Jurnee Newsom is able to have them.
So we have a look at the odds for this fight. You've got Jurnee Newsom, who opened a +130, he's a +135. Garcia opened at a -150, he's a -165. We have a look at the Tapology votes. They're surprised to us, they are to you. I'm going to say over-under on the guy who's won a number of fights in a row versus the guy who's lost a number of fights in a row. I'm going to say over-under 67.5% Garcia.
Do you think it's over? You said that the other way around, I think. I think Garcia will be the favorite.
Yeah, Garcia is a giant favorite with the fans. 636 total votes, 91% Garcia, 38% by decision, 55% by knockout. The man's won 1 fight by knockout. 9% of fans have Newsom to win, 68% of them have him to win by decision. But this is an interesting fight. It's a little bit of an odd fight. Who are you picking here?
If Jurnee Newsom's the fighter that I think he is, he should win this fight. But he's not the fighter I think he is at all. Fernie Garcia on the feet. I do like his volume quite a bit more in this matchup. But again, I do worry about what happens if he gets taken down for like a minute and a half. Is he going to be able to do something big himself in the second half of the round and then get it back in the judges' mind? I just think he'll be steady enough throughout the fight to be able to get a decision. But it should be a fun fight.
Yeah, it really is a weird one. I mean, if you look at it on Instagram, it seems like Jurnee Newsom's been practicing in the gi for the last year and a half. So if that is the case and he goes in there, begins to wrestle, goes for his grappling, huge opportunity to win. But for me, I do like the activity out of Garcia. The one giant thing for Fernie Garcia, he doesn't check leg kicks. He gets kicked terribly in that Hayes fight where Garcia was a -950 favorite. That's what led Hayes into that fight, was those leg kicks. And realistically, when you watch Fernie Garcia box, he doesn't really switch stances. So if you can really eliminate that lead leg, it could cause him a lot of problems. Oh, by the way, Jurnee Newsom doesn't throw a ton of kicks either. So it should be an interesting matchup. I do ever so slightly have Fernie Garcia in this one. So let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this big-time bantamweight fight. Up at the top of the card, 2 title fights. Carlos Esparza, Rosnam Yunus, and then Gaethje looking to challenge Charles Oliveira. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Bantamweights collide coming up this weekend. We have the Mexican-Canadian Lupe Godinez taking on John Lineker's spirit. Animal? Spirit?
If Jessica Andrade didn't exist.
If Jessica Andrade didn't exist, you'd end up with Ariane Carnelosi. And it's such an interesting fight because for Carnelosi, comes into the UFC and they went, okay, well, in the past, you know, you fought Amanda Ribas on the regional scene. Like, you have some fights that a lot of people recognize. How about Angela Hill? And Ariane took that fight and looked all right at points in that fight and then ultimately ended up getting finished in that fight due to a grotesque cut. Now, she comes back after a bit of a layoff, takes on Liang Nan in that fight. Listen, if Jeff Molina and Arichi Long didn't happen at UFC 261, that probably would have been a fight of the
Incredible
night.
Incredible fight.
But it wasn't. And Carnelosi and Liang Na had an amazing fight. Carnelosi ends up getting the finish. Bit of an odd stoppage, but a good one by the end of it. And so she comes out after another bit of a layoff, and she gets another big-time finish win in the third round over Stella Nunes, and that was an amazing one. So Carnelosi coming into this one, having won two fights in a row. For Lupita Godinez, somebody that was known to fight every other weekend, whether that be at 115 or 125, including her fight on super short notice against Luana Carolina. But for Godinez, she's been away for about 6 months. I listened to an interview with Sportskeeda and Daniel Vreeland, and she basically said she's been training and improving and just trying to get a fight. So an interesting one for Godinez, your former LFA champ. So this one is between a couple of fighters who are very dynamic. They can get it done in a lot of different ways. I absolutely love this piece of matchmaking here this weekend.
And what I really like about it is this is going to be the best win on either fighter's record going forward, no matter what, and it's not even close. Because I'll be honest, I've had a hard time breaking down Lupita Godinez at the UFC level. Her fights always have this weird, oh, by the way, to them. It's either she's fighting in a weight class that she doesn't really belong in, it's on short notice. It's always seemed thrown together at the last second. And that's why this fight with an actual full training camp should be a great one against Carnelosi, because stylistically, these two athletes match up very, very well. They can both get it done on the feet. They both get it done in similar but different ways on the ground. And that's why I think it's going to be interesting to see who goes for the first takedown in this fight. Because Carnelosi is interesting. I think she's the better offensive grappler in this matchup, but she's the way worse defensive grappler in this matchup. That's the weird thing. I think Carnelosi could get on top of Godinez, hit her with great ground and pound, and look truly dominant in that top position in this fight. The flip side is, I do think Godinez off of her back can offer a little bit more resistance than what Carnelosi would be able to off of her back if she was in a similar situation. Because with Carnelosi, when you're one of these fighters, when you're a baseball player like Chris Davis, who it's either home run or strike out, yeah, the home runs are really good, but the flip side to that is, if you're spending all that energy early on, if you're going for these big takedowns a la Jessica Andrade, what type of a fighter are you going to look like in the third round against someone like Lupita Godinez, who can scramble, can throw for volume? And I know Carnelosi and cardio haven't been an issue for her in the past, but Godinez is someone who's very steady from the first minute of a fight to the last minute of a fight. So I'm very curious to see, at what temperature does Carnelosi burn at, for lack of a better term? Does she go in there looking to be very aggressive early on? Does she play more of the defensive-minded fighter in that first round? See what Godinez brings at her? Because this is what I will say. I actually think if Carnelosi does wait for Godinez, it will open up some power shots for Carnelosi. And that is the one thing that I think, no matter what Godinez does, she could become the better stylistic puncher. She could get the better technique behind her craft. She'll never hit as hard as Carnelosi, though. She genuinely does have, like, that 1% power in this weight division. So it will be interesting to see, how does Godinez deal with the power of Carnelosi? And how does Carnelosi deal with just a well-rounded game of Godinez?
So the craziest part about this one, when it comes to striking technique, it goes to Godinez. When you look at the way that Carnelosi strikes, upon further review of the tape study, before every blitz and flurry, because that's what she does. She just throws her arms out there and goes. Now, she is a little bit more crisp with one shot over the other, but the trouble is she drops her left hand right before she goes to strike every single time. Every single time she blitzes, she drops it. So she could get countered if she's pressuring forward, and she gets hit clean right down the middle in a lot of her exchanges. Now, she has a power advantage against just about everybody. She can drop just about everybody again, but if we go back, Nell Young dropped her with the first shot she threw. It was just a straight right hand that hit her flush right in the face and sent her down to the canvas. So again, I love watching Ariane Carnelosi fight. I think she's an amazing fighter, great grappler. Even before that fight against Nell Young, she was competing at she won a no-gi competition right before that. Alexander Romanov's been winning no-gi competitions lately, and look what he did to Chase Sherman. But for Carnelosi, the scariest part about it, and I want to make sure that I get this right, because after that Nelly Young fight, she had to get cleared to fight because she had that slipped disc issue in her back. And it's happened twice so far in her UFC tenure. Definitely not a great thing at this point in your career to have.
But that was something we put a lot of stock into before her last performance. And she did look amazing against Estella Nunes. So I don't know how much stock I put in that. Still, it is something that has to be brought up because it has happened a couple of times. But I remember thinking that was going to be a very big talking point into her last fight. And she did look great coming out of that and didn't have any significant injuries.
Did look good there. And again, Liang Na was able to get the takedowns against her. Had her in a Mana Crucifix at one point too. Carnelosi was able to get out of those against Estella Nunes. Did a lot of chasing around, but once she was able to mix in the takedowns, we know now that against Sam Hughes and against Ariana Carnelosi, Estella Nunes is not very good on the ground. Now, that's a lot about Carnelosi. When we look at it for Godinez, the fight against Jessica Penne in the debut, listen, you can make an argument either way. It's a loss on her record. She ends up getting the win over Silvana Gomez-Juarez. That's definitely a good one.
Where it was a 37-year-old making her UFC debut.
Ends up getting the finish in that one. Doesn't matter who it is. It matters how you do it. And then her last time out, she's able to get the win over Loma Lookbunmi, where Loma was coming off a win where she had completely out-grappled Sam Hughes. And then out there against Lupita Godinez, Godinez completely out-grappled Loma, who we know as such a great Thai striker, but really mixing things in at Bang Tao. So when I look at this fight, again, both of them, good grapplers, both good strikers. Everybody does it in a different way in this one. We look at the odds. Carnelosi opened him plus 130. She's a plus 170 underdog. Godinez opened at a minus 130, minus 200 right now. Tapology votes are a surprise to us there to you. I'm going to say over under 60% Godinez.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. It's under. So 674 total votes, 55% Carnelosi, 80% by decision. For the 45% that have Godinez, 86% by decision. So Matt, the fan voting on Topology disagrees with the odds. I'm surprised that Lupita Godinez is this big of a favorite.
So am I. To me, this fight's a pick 'em if there ever was one. And I never say this, especially for a prediction video. I kind of like Carnelosi in this, and I definitely like her at 170, because I do think stylistically they match up very well together. It's technique versus power, but really everywhere, be it on the feet or in the grappling, and that's why this is going to be an incredible fight no matter who wins. But I do think that the cardio of Carnelosi is kind of underrated. She's someone who can throw a crazy amount of output and still be active in that third round. So I do think with her already strength advantage, I do think with her underrated cardio, she'll at least be able to stay and maintain that level in the third round, and that's why I do Carnelosi in this fight, but this is as evenly matched as any on the card.
Super evenly matched, and the odds are like that. So, like some other shows that are out there on the internet would say, it's dog or pass. But when I do look at this one, I like Lupita Godinez. When it comes to her scramble ability, when it comes to her offensive wrestling, is her jiu-jitsu on the same level as Carnelosi? Not necessarily. Is her punching power there with Carnelosi's? Not necessarily. Carnelosi is one of the sloppiest strikers for a Muay Thai artist you're going to find in this division.
And that's why I like her in this fight, though. She's fighting someone who doesn't really have the punching power to make her pay for that. And I know she got dropped two fights ago, but I look at when Jessica Andrade got dropped by Angela Hill. If you're really aggressive and you get hit by a shot you don't see, it doesn't matter what the person's punching power is. It just might make you slip and go down. So for Carnelosi, I don't think she's going to get caught by a big shot by Godinez on the feet. I do think if she loses, it's going to be because Godinez goes out there and thoroughly out-grapples her in the top position for 15 minutes.
Both of us split on the pick. I'm going with the Mexican Canadian Lupita Godinez. Remember UFC Moncton, Matt going with Brazil's own Ariane Carnelosi to get the win. It's a big time fight in the strawweight division and up near the top in the co-main event. The belt is on the line between Naomi Yunus and Carla Sparza. In the main event, Charles Oliveira taking on Justin Gaethje. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
If you head on over to the social media platform that is Instagram, Cledson Rodriguez has 25,000 Instagram followers, which pales in comparison to like Tracy Cortez or Rose Namajunas, who has 2.5 million.
Wow.
But for KR, lose the nickname, making his UFC debut coming up this weekend. He is a very, very intriguing prospect out of Brazil. You head on over to that Instagram game, and he trains out of a few different gyms. One being Team Nogueira, so you see a little...
You may have heard of them.
You know, the brothers. But you see Juliana Velasquez, former Bellator flyweight champ. Yikes. And you also see him at Tropa Team, which is Shaymon Moraes' gym. He just got a big win over with the PFL last week, so an interesting one. Former UFC man.
Had a tough run in the UFC, but still a very good fighter.
And a buddy of Kledson, and they seem to be main training partners, is Felipe Klarish, who I wish we get to see more often. I like a Felipe Klarish fight. The guy's got grit. The guy is an interesting fighter. So for Kledson, he's a former Jungle Fights flyweight champ. He was a champ back in 2019. The weird thing, if you do look at it for Rodriguez, young guy, but a fairly lengthy layoff from 2.5 years ago to when he fought about 6 months ago on Contender Series. He took on Santo Curatolo, and that was a bit of a short notice replacement that he ended up facing. Looked very, very good. Curatolo didn't get started. It was like listening to, I almost said the Red Hot Chili Peppers. That would have been a big mistake. It was like listening to Mick Jagger and Keith Richards and just getting that guitar riff over and over again, because he never started up, did Curatolo, in that fight. Rodriguez looked very, very good, and Dana White just basically said, well, this one's a no-brainer. Get over here, kids. So Rodriguez ends up in the UFC. Big opportunity against CJ Vergara, a guy who came in off of Contender Series as well. But Vergara had a more impressive fight on Contender Series, where he finished UFC vet Bruno Correa in that one. Knee to the body, big finish, makes his UFC debut against Ode Osborne. And it was a shame too, right? Because it wasn't a Conor McGregor card, so Conor didn't get to fight on an Ode card. But Ode did fight Vergara, beat him in the first two rounds. Vergara rallied in a big way in the third round of that fight. And I think a lot of people are just down on the fact that CJ Vergara lost Ode Osborne. And now he gets a really good prospect, and now we're here.
And that's why I know we've gone up and down this card, and we really like the matchmaking for the most part. This one is a bit of an odd fight for Vergara, because I do think he's a very good fighter. He's a very talented fighter. Like you said, he showed tremendous heart his last time out by rallying late in his fight. But it is strange that you're giving a guy who himself is a promising, maybe prospect's a bit of a stretch, just giving him to what, for all intents and purposes, is an absolute killer in his UFC debut.
Give him Zhalgash Yumagulov.
Exactly. A name like that would make a lot of sense, because for Kledson Rodriguez, and I know, Rodriguez, I know you'll appreciate this reference. Fighting him must be like trying to be a batter against Nestor Cortez Jr. He's just throwing so much at you that it is really hard to get your own timing, and that's what I noticed the most when I noticed opponents of Rodriguez. You're right. It's almost like they are in a bit of like a defensive shell, because you don't want to extend yourself too much. He can box from both stances. He throws really good kicks too, to the body and to the head. The one criticism I will give of Rodriguez, it's a positive and it's a bit of a negative. He likes to throw head kicks when he's chest to chest with his opponent sometimes. It's a little weird, and against guys who are very good grapplers, it might be something that could catch him in the future, but it's also really nice that he has that level of dexterity in his hips to be able to get his foot up so high. It just... He's such a very unique offensive fighter that I do think fighters, when they're on the other side of the cage from him, it puts a lot of question marks into their own mind, because if you're fighting someone who might not be as explosive, but they're a lot more traditional, it's like, okay, this isn't too bad. I either just have to deal with the boxing, I just have to deal with the kicks. Rodriguez is sort of an anomaly when it comes to his striking on the feet, so that's why I think it'll be interesting. What type of CJ Vergara do we see this weekend? Is he going to go out there, shoot some takedowns, try to get into dirty boxing range? Because that's the thing, Vergara's the more well-rounded in this matchup, but he's one of these wrestlers who... I don't know if he's good enough to just go out there and take Rodriguez down 12 times out of 12. I think he'll have to fight a little bit more for the takedown attempt, but I only say that because of the movement of Rodriguez. I think if Vergara can get him up against the cage, he will be able to chain wrestle much more effectively than Rodriguez can, but I do think Clipson's one of these fighters who his movement's going to give CJ a lot of issues early on, especially with his wrestling, but if Rodriguez starts to slow down, round two, round three, that's when we could see CJ start to take over.
Clipson Rodriguez seems to get stronger as fights go on.
He does.
So if you watch that fight where he took on Curatolo, I don't want to harp on it too much, because again, you can't take recency bias into it. I'll talk about some of his other fights. But on that card, you also had Steven Nguyen, you had Michael Morales, a very, very exciting prospect, and AJ Dobson, not as exciting, but had a good performance
card,
on that one. And you look at it for Rodriguez, 23 strikes total in the first round, 37 in the second, 39 in the third. He went 4 of 6 on defending the takedowns, and he was quick on his first move back up to his feet. And when I went to watch Rodriguez back on the Jungle Fight series, the thing that I picked up on out of this guy is lightning fast with his hands, very nice kicks, hips are on hinges the way that they're able to move, but he can get hit by some shots. And again, everybody's hittable. Like, everybody in this world is hittable. Not everybody's Khabib Nurmagomedov, and even Khabib got hit in some of his fights, not that much, but he gets hit by odd shots. He doesn't really get hit by the shots straight up the middle. It's more the hooks. And his fight with Silva, that's what I noticed. It was Rodriguez moves very well, but he's one of those guys that, like, plants his feet flat and then he jumps up and springs around. He's not on the balls of his feet all the time. And when you're like that and you take that 1 second to just freeze, just take a second, because he does move a lot, that's when he's susceptible to getting hit. And Vergara is one of those strikers. At a Pete Spratt Muay Thai, who Pete Spratt beat Robbie Lawler one time, it really happened. You have two power gyms here. I think, again, matchmaking's good, maybe not the greatest in this fight, but it's just, I have a hard time taking Vergara in this fight. And it's unfortunate because I really do like his skill set. And if he wins this weekend, I wouldn't necessarily be surprised, but it would be one of the more surprising ones on the card overall.
I definitely, exactly. The best version of CJ Vergara could go in there and beat Clayson Rodriguez. But I look at Rodriguez kind of like Jonathan Kuminga for the Golden State Warriors. He doesn't play a lot in the playoffs because he's crazy athletic, but he's still kind of learning the finer, minute details of the sport. For Rodriguez, I really like the talent that I do see, but I agree with you. He does get hit by some shots that you go, really? You can do all this offensively. You have all this great movement, but like a really steady jab and an uppercut every now and then can clip him, because he will duck at some points when almost being upright would be better for him defensively. I still like the prospect that I have seen, though, and I do think that he's going to be in the UFC for quite a while, and that's probably why the UFC gave him CJ Vergara off of a loss for his debut. I feel like they do see a special talent in Rodriguez, so it should be interesting to see him grow in this division that definitely does need new talent. Like, flyweight's in a good spot right now, I think we can all agree on that, but it's still not the deepest of divisions. It's one of those divisions where it might only go 20 deep, even though the top 15 are really good, so it'll be interesting to see how Rodriguez gets matched up in the future.
I'm going to do this differently to end the video. Rodriguez minus 280 favorite right now. Vergara a plus 225 or thereabouts. The Tapology votes are overwhelmingly in Rodriguez's favor. 645 total votes, 85% for Rodriguez, 79% by decision for the 15% that have Vergara, 52% by decision, 30 some odd percent by knockout. The weird part about it is, and this is why I'm going to say this, if you look at Clayton Rodriguez, I say 9 times out of 10 he wins the first round out of this fight. So I think Rodriguez is going to win the first round unless Vergara's wrestling overwhelms him. But apart from that, CJ Vergara is a guy that turns it up, not just in the Ode Osborne fight. Go look at his record. Go watch his fights. Plenty of finishes in the second round and the third round. I wouldn't be surprised again. Vergara turns it on. And I never say this. It's usually, okay, guy wins first round, guy wins the second round. Just don't get finished in the third round. He probably wins a fight. Vergara is one of those guys that if he turns it on, like you saw Marlon Vera do, if you turn it on round two, round three, Vergara has a chance to win. So maybe watch the live odds after the first round. But for me, I do have Rodriguez in this fight. It's just something that I want to throw out there.
I also have Rodriguez, but again, I'm really excited for him and his potential in the UFC. I know we get on here on some of the weaker fight night cards, if we're all being honest. There'll be someone making their debut, and we have to be brutally honest and say, hey, this might just be a 2 or 3 fight UFC caliber fighter. I don't believe that at all with Clayton Rodriguez. Like, I really do think we're going to see him around for a really long time. And the other really great sign is, he's a young prospect. It's not like they're just signing this guy. He's in his 30s and they need him to fill a spot. Like, I do think the UFC's kind of thought about his development plan. I think this is the first step in it.
Big time opportunity for both these guys. They're both going with Team Nogueira's KR, change the nickname, Clayton Rodriguez, to get the win. Two big title fights up at the top. Charles Oliveira taking on Justin Gaethje and Carla Esparza in the rematch against Rose Namajunas. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Grapplers of a different kind are set to meet this weekend at flyweight as we have Tracy Cortez representing Fight Ready MMA taking on Brazil's undefeated Melissa Gatto. And when I look at this fight, and I have to be completely honest with everybody out there, I've had a weird picking history with Melissa Gatto. I mean, she makes her UFC debut against former Invicta fighter Victoria Leonardo. And in that fight, I couldn't take myself to pick Gatto in that one. I mean, she had a 3-year layoff. She had a 1-year suspension by USADA because she tested positive for furosemide. And in that one, Gatto outstrikes Leonardo 70-43, and then in her fight against Sajara Eubanks, she outstrikes her 64-32. Now, I did pick Gatto to beat Eubanks, but I picked Leonardo to beat Gatto, and the big sticking point was Melissa Gatto takedown defense is poor, but it's Mackenzie Dern takedown defense because her jiu-jitsu...
Wait, it's a trap!
It's light out. It lights out, and when you look at her striking on the Brazilian scene, it was bad. Like, it was just straight up bad. Single shots, jab, no right hand, no kicks whatsoever. But over that three-year layoff, it's like she completely transformed her striking. She's become a much more fluid striker. Nice kicks. Better hands. Not great, but better. The trouble is, when she goes to throw her punches, she leads with her head, and then she throws her arms out there. She's very, very hittable. But coming up this weekend, Moscato doesn't really have to worry about that. Because for Tracy Cortez, other than the Google search I did in anticipation for this one, because I went, okay, what have we seen out of Tracy Cortez in the UFC? She's undefeated. She was great in Invicta. She won a contender series. She has a crazy life story. A
little hittable.
She's involved with Brian Ortega, doing my Google searches, getting pictures, getting info. And then all of a sudden I see a picture of Brian Ortega, the inside is lit. Now people can see I have no tattoo here. But Brian Ortega has Tracy with a heart tattooed on the inside of his lip. He also has a headline that goes to the fact that she's this gorgeous boxer. When the hell was Tracy Cortez a gorgeous boxer? Who wrote this?
It's kind of like
AI?
It's like when you do, like when we used to break down Kay Hansen fights. Like, she was a boxer. She was like 2-6 in box. Like, you could be a boxer too, Craig. We could throw that in a headline. Like, we'll get you to, we can get you to do like some, yeah, you can do like some boxing lessons. We can get you that point. This is a weird fight, and I hope you agree with me on this. If these two fought in, like, Submission Underground for Chael Sonnen, the result would be the same of what their MMA fight is. Because you're right, Gato, not a great striker at all. No, I shouldn't
She's
say that.
She's gotten better.
She's a basic striker, and that doesn't mean it's poor, that doesn't mean it's good. It's just what she is. She throws a very steady 1-2. You're right, does get a little over-aggressive with her own flurries, but she doesn't have terrible punching power, and I think that's why she does get a little over-aggressive, because if I leave myself wide open, what are you going to do? You're either going to hit me with a big counter shot, or you're going to take her down. And you do not want to take Melissa Gatto down, because that was the one thing that you could take from her pre-UFC tenure that you could transfer over to the UFC octagon. If you're on the ground with her for really any minute of any time, you are in danger of getting submitted. She has very, very good hips off of her back, and she's someone who can pivot on her spine. It's really weird. It's like she has wheels on her back that she can always just go around on, because she's constantly in a set position, but she does what I really like about Charles Oliveira. When Charles Oliveira grapples, it's like seeing a black widow eat a bug. He's just all over it all the time, getting it in a bigger web. Gatto likes to move a lot, even though she can get set in set positions defensively, but she's always attacking with something. And against someone like Tracy Cortez, who definitely has the wrestling advantage in this matchup, but will she have the grappling advantage once it does hit the mat? Because I think Tracy Cortez could get some good ground and pound off, really sap some of the cardio from Melissa Gatto if she's able to get on top of her early and really make her pay for it. But Gatto is such a threat off of her back, and especially on top, because that's the thing. We normally see Melissa Gatto in a lot of her fights fighting off her back and using her jiu-jitsu in that way in a lot of areas. If she is on top of Tracy Cortez for even 5 seconds, and this isn't hyperbole, if she gets top position on Tracy Cortez, the fight's as good as over, because Cortez is a really good wrestler in top position, but off her back, you do worry. She's a little bit slow with some of her own escapes, and that's what I worry about. If Gatto can make this fight less about the set positions, kind of like what Casey O'Neill did against Antonina Shevchenko, I think Melissa Gatto could end up looking like a world beater, and we could be talking about her as like the jiu-jitsu ace in the top 15 of this division.
So Gatto broke Victoria Leonardo arm, finished Sachera Eubanks with a body kick in the third round. Tracy Cortez, again, in the UFC, undefeated, takes on Maria Agapova, beats her by decision. Before that, over with Invicta, I thought Erin Blanchfield beat her. After that, beats Vanessa Mello.
And that's the thing, I was going to ask you that. Do you feel like the Blanchfield win is still her best one? Controversial as it may be, I would say Blanchfield's probably the best name on her record.
It is, because the Stephanie Egger fight, she wins. Now, that's an impressive win. At 135 to beat Egger, I love it. And then in her last fight, she misses weight and takes on Justine Kish.
Now, disappointing.
Justine Kish, your next title challenger if they don't rematch for the belt at flyweight over with Bellator. Kish just beat Alima Leigh McFarlane handily, which is wild. But Kish beat Tracy Cortez, and somehow Tracy Cortez was given a decision win, just like Arlovsky beat Collier. Kish dropped Tracy Cortez in the third round of that fight and beat her before that. So, I mean, again, I have a hard time. I really do. I thought, again, round one, round two, maybe there's an argument that Cortez won it. So Derek Cleary scored it that way. Sal D'Amato had it round two, round three for Kish. And Rick Winter gave all three to Cortez. Which is, it doesn't make any sense. The other thing out of Cortez, Matt, just before I hand it over to you. Again, we talk about the kicks. Gatto started to employ them more in her game. Tracy Cortez in the UFC. 2 against Agapova, 10 in her next fight, 6 in her next fight, 7 in her next fight. Trace Cortez does not kick. She's thrown 25 kicks in 4 UFC and UFC adjacent fights. Moscato's fought twice in the UFC and she's thrown 20. And they've landed. So again, the striking, it's tough to say that it favors Gatto because she strikes like Gina Mazzani. Leads with her head and then throws her arms out there. But in a matchup like this where it comes to two grapplers with Trace Cortez having a wrestling advantage and Melissa Gatto being lights out with BJJ, I've set it up a way that I don't normally do it with fight night picks.
I'm at the point now where it's, okay, if you grapple with Melissa Gatto, you're probably going to lose the fight. That's just how I look at a lot of her fights in my mind. I know that might be a bit of an exaggeration, but she really is at that level with her jiu-jitsu. Like, I'm not trying to sell you some used car that's real bad on the inside that just looks nice on the outside. Like, Gatto's grappling is at that world-class level. And my problem with Tracy Cortez is that, could she wrestle her way to a win? She could. But she's not a good enough striker to win a fight with just 15 minutes of striking. I think she's proved that in her UFC tenure. She's a steadier striker, I would say, than Gatto. But again, she's going to need her wrestling at some point throughout this fight. And to me, I just don't think you want to mess around with Gatto on the mat whatsoever. If Cortez was a little bit better on her feet, if she could stick with the jab a little bit more, then maybe I would pick her to secure a couple rounds early and just do enough in the third round, be sound defensively to win a decision. But for Gatto being an underdog, I really like her in this matchup, to be honest.
Tracy Cortez, I mean, right now, sitting in and about a big enough favorite to where it kind of surprised me before we did the video. So if you look at it, Cortez open at a minus 225. She's minus 175 right now. Gatto open a plus 190. She's plus 150. Heading on over to, wow, I get ahead of myself, to Tapology. The votes are as surprised to us as they are to you, but I'm going to say over under 75% for the fighter that has 437,000 Instagram followers, Trace Cortez.
I'll say under. I think it's closer to 50-50.
Slightly, yeah. So 646 total votes, 62% Cortez, 92% by decision, 38% that I've got to, 60% by decision, 14% by submission, 19% by knockout. The math doesn't add up, but trust me, that's what those numbers are on Tapology. Sometimes they don't add up. Again, I normally don't set things up this way with Fight Night picks, but I've got Melissa Gatto. I think she's going to go out there and win by submission.
I like that. Yeah, I like that prediction, honestly. It's just, for Cortez, we've never seen her win an MMA fight with just her striking. At every point, she has to go for a takedown during her fights. Is Melissa Gatto the fighter that you ever want to take down? No, not at all, because she's not just a grappler who has to get it done from top position, or she struggles off her back. She's great in both those positions, and this is one of those fights. Since Tracy Cortez is engaged to Brian Ortega now, Brian Ortega fought Thiago Tavares way back in the day in 2015. He spends 15 minutes of that fight. I know the fight's only 15 minutes. He spends the majority of that fight off his back, throwing up ground and pound at Thiago Tavares. He ends up knocking him out near the end of that fight, but that was one of the first fights I remember watching, and the commentary said, I know Ortega's on his back, but like, he might be winning this fight because he's landing better strikes off his back. He's threatening with submissions. I could kind of see this fight going in a similar pattern to that. The difference is, I think Gatto will be the one who wins.
Both of us going with Brazil's Melissa Gatto as the underdog in this matchup. Let us know if you're going with the favorite here in Tracy Cortez, or if you do have Gatto. Two big fights up at the top for the titles. You've got Nami Yunus defending against Esparza. You've got Oliveira defending against Gaethje. Not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend at welterweight, we have your But Why fight of the weekend. It is an ageless wonder coming up in Francisco Trinaldo, Masaron Duba taking on Hot Chocolate Danny Roberts. And listen, this is a fight between Brazil and the United Kingdom, and realistically it's also a fight of South Florida, as you have Sanford MMA represented by Roberts and American Top Team with Constrictor Team's former guy, the former lightweight. It is Trinaldo. And if you've watched any of Francisco Trinaldo's fights throughout his illustrious UFC career, I have to say he's probably not going to end up in the history books for much, but he's going to be one of the more remembered and less remembered fighters, if there
is
ever was
one. Is he your Stromile Swift of UFC and MMA?
He's kind of in the category of another Brazilian fighter, Rafael Assunção, where it's like nobody's ever going to talk about Assunção.
Assunção beat TJ Dillashaw, though.
He did, but he never got his due. He never fought for the title, but he did beat
main events,
Dillashaw.
Though.
The thing is, these are guys that just aren't going to be appreciated by your average fan. Nobody's going to be talking about Trinaldo at the end of the day, but gosh darn it, I will. I will. Masaron Duba. But a weird fight nonetheless, because if you look at it, Francisco Trinaldo has something in his back pocket that Danny Roberts does not. and it's his grappling and his wrestling. Danny Roberts, not a grappler, not a wrestler. When it comes to the striking, both guys over their long UFC careers have similar output, but they definitely do it in different ways. And for Trinaldo, again, we can split hairs. We can say, well, the Alexander Hernandez fight should have gone this way, so on and so forth. Well, the Bobby Green fight should have gone this way. You look at the 5-on-in for Francisco Trinaldo, win over Green, win over McDessie, knockout win over Mr. Jai Herbert, a boring, boring fight against Muslim Salikov, awful, moving up to 170, and then a win by split decision over Dwight Grant where there was an eye poke, and realistically, Masaran Duba probably should have won that fight if the eye poke wasn't a thing. For Danny Roberts, 3-2 in the 5-on-in, win over David Zavada by split, that was a fight of the night way back when Fight Night Picks started, a loss to Claudio Silva by submission, another one of those guys that's going to fly under the radar but has a win over Leon Edwards. Lost to Michelle Pereira by knockout, a knockout win over Salim Imadiyev, and then a split decision win over Ramzan Amiev his last time out. I wish we get to see Danny Roberts fight more often because I love to watch him fight, but gosh darn it, this is an odd one, but a good one.
Everyone, I want you to come in here for a second. I'm going to teach everyone about trees for a second, okay? So the thing about trees is, when you try to figure out how old they are, you got to cut it down, you got to count the rings, and then you figure out how old that tree is. To me, Francisco Trinaldo might be like 10 years older than Danny Roberts, but Danny Roberts feels like he has at least as many rings inside of him as Francisco Trinaldo. He's just taken a lot of damage at this stage of his career, especially as of late, which has been a little bit disturbing to see because Roberts' style is based around, I'm going to eat a shot, I'm going to give a shot, I'm going to be one of those kind of blood and gut type brawlers. Now, he does have technical boxing, but I think when Danny Roberts is in the cage, it might start out as, I want to be a technical boxer, but I think we've all watched him fight enough at this point to know he gets hit like one time and then it's off to the races, and that's why we all like watching Hot Chocolate fight so much. Again, he's one of these names who might not be talked about in the future very much, but if you're around for this span in the UFC, you probably have one fight of his that you really enjoyed watching. It's just been really strange because for Masaran Duba, as his career's progressed, I thought his footwork has got a little bit better. He's not as available to hit. But there's a flip side to that. He's garbage at cutting off the cage. It's something he's never really got better at, and it was something that was very apparent in that James Vick fight. I know Vick was surging at the time, but Masaran Duba fought a very good fight, and in the third round, he really needed that round, and he definitely won it, but he found himself chasing James Vick a lot in that third round because he wasn't able to cut him off using the cage. He just sort of followed him around in circles over and over and over again. He's fixed a little bit of that as of late, but again, the saying you can't teach an old dog new tricks, it's around for a reason, and at 43, you kind of know what you're going to get out of Trinaldo. I do like what you mentioned, though, about his grappling. It's not really something we see as often as you might like, because he does have explosive takedowns, he does have a really nice grappling game, especially with his top position, but when he cocks an overhand left and unloads it, even at the age of 43, they say power goes last, and really, Francisco Trinaldo is one of the best examples of this. Ask Jai Herbert how that felt. And I know Jai Herbert didn't have the best run in the UFC, but still, Trinaldo in his 40s completely knocked him out cold, and it at least, it extended his career to where not a lot of people thought he'd still be in the UFC, especially not fighting this weekend. So I think this is going to be a great fight, even though neither guy's probably going to get into the top 15 of this division.
Probably not.
You did say Michelle Pereira was like a 10 to 15 guy earlier.
He could be a 10 to 15 guy at some point. So Francisco Trinaldo, for those who don't know, if we haven't ingrained it in your mind enough, this is the B-dub-dubs fact of the week. He was born in 1978. He's been around the block. So I thought, what old records do I have from not before 1978, but after? And I went with, okay, well, I've got Can't Slow Down by Lionel Richie. Got that in the collection. And guess what? Francisco Trinaldo can't friggin' slow down. It's just insane to see how his career has progressed and that we're at this point with him. So I look at the odds for this fight. Roberts open a plus 120. Now minus 106. You look at it for Trinaldo, open a minus 140. Now a minus 115. We have a look at the fan vote over on Tapology. Surprised us, it is to you. I'm going to say over under 60% Roberts here.
I'll say over.
Younger fighter. Nope. 652 total votes, 63% Trinaldo, 73% have him to win by decision for the 37% that have Roberts, 74% have him to win by decision. So it seems like people are thinking decision for a win with either guy. Not necessarily known for their finishing prowess. This is a tough one to pick, though.
It's a tough one to pick, but I do think I figured out how I'm going to predict this. I want to pick Francisco Trinaldo. I think he can have the bigger moments in this fight, but this is one of those fights where I'm going to pick Danny Roberts. I think Danny Roberts is probably going to destroy Trinaldo, and then we're all going to be asking ourselves, why do we think Trinaldo had such a good chance to begin with? Because that is the one thing about Francisco that he's not great with. His output is very high and very low. There are some of those periods throughout fights where he's really trying to set up that one big shot, and the problem is, if you don't land the one big knockout punch, you're probably going to lose by decision because the volume of Danny Roberts is quite a bit better, especially on the in-betweens with his own boxing. So I do think Roberts, with his pressure and with his boxing, and the fact that he's a decade younger than Francisco Trinaldo, is probably going to help him a little bit. And then the last thing that we haven't really talked about,
Danny Roberts' platinum blonde hair. Because he has it now.
Roberts would have to cut off a leg to make 155. And Francisco Trinaldo is a lifelong lightweight who has been forced to move up to welterweight, mainly because the weight cut has been really hard on him at this stage of his career, because he is in his 40s. So Roberts is going to be the bigger guy. I think he's going to have more power. He has the steadier output. And that's why I like Danny Roberts in this fight.
Again, it did not work for Daniel Da Silva Lacerda last weekend, but he went bleach blonde. So he kind of cheaped out. He did the high school hockey hair type of thing. Danny Roberts invested in it, even though he had short hair. He's platinum blonde for this one, training out of Sanford MMA. I like the combination for Roberts. I didn't think that he beat Ramazan Ameev. I thought he lost the first two rounds. But coming into this one, Matt, it is an important fight for these guys moving forward in their respective UFC careers. And for Danny Roberts, again, output, it is tough because both guys have similar output career-wise in the UFC. But it is on the in-betweens where Trinaldo can take moments off, whereas I do like Roberts as the steadier guy to at least be doing something. So going with the much younger fighter here representing England, both of us with Danny Roberts in this matchup. Do you have old man Masaran Duba? Because guess what? He can't slow down. It's a great fight. And I almost said Leonardo, but Lionel Richie's eyes in the back of that one. Kind of scary.
Piercing.
Piercing, some would say. Big time opportunity for both of these guys. And hello, was this a channel you were looking for? Don't forget to drop a like under this video and keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say, let's get into it. The former World Series of Fighting and PFL heavyweight champ, Blagoy Baga Ivanov, coming back after just a week shy of 2 years away from the cage. He's going to be taking on Brazil's Pesão, Marcos Rogério de Lima, a guy who decided, you know what, my job's probably on the line. I should go ham in my next one. And knock out Ben Rothwell, BKFC zone. And if you don't believe what I just said, it's fact. And I know it's crazy, and it seems crazy coming out of my mouth.
It's like when Tim Tebow tried out for the MLB. You know, you're like, really? This the next thing you're doing?
And then he did it for a long time in the minors. He was committed. But the craziest part about
this... I don't question Ben Rothwell's commitment to BKFC. I just question the sport.
Ben Rothwell hadn't been knocked out since UFC 104 when he took on Cain Velasquez. That was his first knockout loss in many, many, many years. And for Marcos Rogério de Lima, here's the weirdest part about his career. He comes into the UFC off the Ultimate Fighter Brazil at heavyweight. He fought Shoeface there. You know, PFL champion Shoeface. And listen, Rogério has his first fight in the UFC at heavyweight, mingles at light heavyweight, but weighing in at the limit was a problem, so he ends up moving back to heavyweight. Here's his record in the UFC between those two divisions. This is very important. 5-2 at heavyweight, 3-3 at light heavyweight. I think it's safe to say that heavyweight is his division now. For Rogério de Lima, his striking is great. His Muay Thai is amazing. His takedown defense is bad. His bottom game is bad. His first move back up to his feet is terrible. Blagoy Ivanov, 2008 World Combat Sambo champion. He beat Fedor that year in Combat Sambo, a guy who was very good at, well, Combat Sambo. And for Blagoy Ivanov, coming into the UFC, I know he's 2-3. I know he's got that loss to Junior Dos Santos in a 5-round main event to make his debut. But you look at it and the wins that he has. He was able to get a win against Ben Rothwell by decision. Beats Tai Tuivasa by decision.
That was a great fight, too.
Loses to Derek Lewis by split decision. I thought Derek Lewis won that one. Loses to Augusto Sakai by split decision. That was the biggest fence grab ever at the end of that fight by Augusto Sakai.
I still thought he beat Blagoy, though.
But realistically, though, for Ivanov, he's a steady striker. And when he works in his wrestling and his grappling, amazing top pressure. Not the heaviest of heavyweights, but realistically, coming into this fight, I think he's at a huge speed disadvantage to Marco Sergio de Lima. It just depends on how much grappling are we going to see out of Ivanov 2 years away from the octagon training at Extreme Couture.
I brought up a lot of basketball references, so I'm going to keep the train going. Blagoy Ivanov, to me, is like watching DeAndre Jordan the past couple of years. He was really good, and he still does the same thing. It's just athletically, he's not the same guy he used to be. And I really worry about these 2 years off, because he was looking slow in his last couple of losses. And I know they were close fights, but still, Blagoy Ivanov was brought into the UFC as, this could be a top 10 guy. He's going to be in the rankings for a long time, might even fight for a title one day. He has two good wins, I would say, in the UFC, but he definitely has not been the fighter that we thought he would be upon his entry.
And somehow he's still ranked, even though he's lost the last two fights, and he hasn't fought in a shade under two years.
The great thing about the heavyweight division, though, right now, is it does feel like it is having somewhat of a resurgence. There's a lot of young fighters right now working their way up the ranks, so a lot of these older fighters who have just sort of been able to stay around the top 15 due to inactivity are starting to get forced out, which is really nice. But it's a good point you bring up. Even though I'm still in that top 15, and for De Lima, to me, he's kind of higher up in the division just because he has been more relevant as of late, but there's really no other way to cut and dry this fight other than De Lima's gonna, he's way better on the feet, it's not even close. He has leg kicks, he has thunderous power, he has really good hand speed too, especially compared to Blagoy Ivanov, but every minute that ticks off the clock, it's just gonna get a little bit harder for him, and a little bit harder for him. And the thing about De Lima is, he's not a great striker when he moves forward. It's weird. He likes it when his opponents come towards him a lot of the time. Then he'll plant and try to throw. And then after he throws, he'll start to flurry forwards. I do think that's going to be a trouble for Blagoy Ivanov, who does tend to just sort of plot forward, not be all that defensively sound sometimes. I could see Ivanov just walking into a big shot, kind of like how Ben Rothwell did. But again, it's so wild to me how confident I was in Ben Rothwell going into the Rogério de Lima fight. Just stylistically, a really bad matchup for de Lima, you'd think. A guy who has great cardio, good striking defense, hadn't been knocked out in like a decade leading up to that. But de Lima hit him with one clean shot and hurt him, and then immediately took him out with the next flurry. So I do feel like de Lima at heavyweight, he's at least found his right body type for this division, because he was at 205, missed weight a few times, weighed in way heavy against OSP when he fought
210.
Yeah, which is really bad. And ever since at heavyweight, he has gone up and down in weight a little bit, but I do feel like as of late, he's really figured out, okay, how can I make the most of my body type at this division? But again, this fight to me is just going to be extreme one-way traffic, one way or the other. It's either de Lima kicks off Ivanov's front leg and hits him with an overhand left, or Blagoy's just going to rinse and repeat his takedowns over and over and over again. But the thing is, de Lima fights a lot like Tai Tuivasa, and he's not as good, of course, he's slower. But Ivanov did look really good against Tai Tuivasa. He ate some big shots, but he even hurt Tai on the feet in that matchup. So Ivanov does have the experience against the higher level of competition.
So you have a look at this fight. Again, Blagoy Ivanov, some sites might still say AKA, but he hasn't trained at AKA in a really long time. He's out of Extreme Couture. And for Marco Sergio de Lima, he's training with the UFC and UFC adjacent Land of Misfit Toys that have been cast away in Marcelo Gomes, Bruno Oliveira, and another big name, Clinton Abreu, who did actually just pick up a big one with PFL last week. When it comes to the odds for this fight, Ivanov open to minus 170 is a minus 155 favorite. Rogério de Lima open to plus 145 is plus 127, so the odds are closing in. Matt, we have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise test there to you. I'm going to say over-under 65% Rogério de Lima.
I think Ivanov will be the favorite.
You think so? And look at that. 693 total votes. 73% Ivanov. 78% by decision for the 27% that have Rogério de Lima. 40% by decision. 46% by knockout. Two big wins over Maurice Green, the crochet boss. And then, of course, Big Ben Rothwell in a row for Rogério de Lima. Matt, what's the pick here?
I like Blagoy Ivanov in this matchup. Again, it's not the sexiest pick, and if he wins, it's probably not going to be in the most aesthetically pleasing way. There's going to be a lot of clinch control, a lot of takedowns that probably don't result in submissions, just a lot of top control, I believe. De Lima, again, if you take away that one big punch he lands on Ben Rothwell, you do think about his career quite a bit differently leading up to that fight. And I'm trying not to get too caught up in De Lima's last performance. I know the power's there. I always knew the power was there. I just feel like that was one of the best versions you'll probably ever see of him. Now, I worry about Ivanov with his 2-year layoff. I worry about the speed disadvantage he's going to bring into this fight. But I do like the well-rounded game of him. And he can eat a big shot. He's been able to do that throughout his career. So if he does get into a bad position, if he does get cracked by a big shot, I'm going to trust his chin to at least be able to eat a couple. And he'll be able to withstand that big storm win a decision.
Realistically, one of these two fighters has beaten a former UFC heavyweight champion in the past. Matt, do you know which fighter it is? Blagoy Ivanov, he beat Rico Rodriguez, Cam Soto MMA's own. Rico Rodriguez. I do have Blagoy Ivanov here. And listen, again, it's not the most fun pick. Blagoy's been off for a very long time, so it definitely does give you cause for concern. Somehow, younger fighter in this matchup, so that's a little bit weird. But again, with the abilities to take down Rogério de Lima, whose takedown defense isn't all that great, and his first move off his back is not all that great, I do have to go with Ivanov. So both of us here are going with Bulgaria's own former combat sambo world champion, former World Series and PFL champion, albeit PFL was just one fight when the promotion switched names, Blagoy Ivanov. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. And listen, two big fights up at the top that aren't for the title. You've got Michael Chandler taking on Tony Ferguson and Cowboy Cerrone taking on Joe Lozon. So you're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Somewhere out there, Rogério Bonturin is watching this fight like Dr. Claw and Inspector Gadget with that Deke intro and really just sitting there watching with ill intent. Because if you look at it for both these guys coming up this weekend, Brandon Royval with a win over Bonturin his last time out by split. Matt Schnell able to get the win over Bonturin at 135 pounds, and that was a bit of an odd one. But both these guys are, you would say, flyweights. I mean, Schnell, obviously, with the more experience lately up there at 135. And they collide coming up this weekend in a possible fight of the night. Now, very much kill or be killed flyweights, which we don't say all that often. You see a lot more of these flyweight fights, especially on the prelims, going to a decision. But when I look at these two guys, incredibly dynamic at what they do in completely different ways, and I absolutely love it. For Schnell, cross-training at multiple different gyms. Years ago, American Top Team, since has resettled in the Louisiana-Houston areas, Fortis MMA, a couple of different gyms around there as well. For Brandon Royval, a Factory X guy through and through, and we've seen a lot of exciting fights from Royval since the Tim Elliott fight on through. So I absolutely love this fight, and realistically, does Bonturin want next, or is he just kind of content with where he's at?
Probably just content with where he's at, because it's weird. The three of these fighters do match up very well, and I include Bonturin into this, because I know he has a win over one and a loss to the other. They were all very competitive and very close fights. They were all very fun fights to go back and rewatch in hindsight. This fight's going to be awesome, though, because Matt Schnell's this really strange fighter who is a great grappler, but we really only see him box inside the UFC for the most part, and it is really odd. He doesn't have bad striking by any means. That is not what I'm here to tell you guys today. But you know, he struggles with taking big punches on the feet, and he's a really good grappler offensively and defensively, so why wouldn't he just try to grapple a little bit more throughout his fights? Because Schnell has a very, very advanced submission game. He's not just somebody who's going to wait in your half guard, wait in full control, or wait in full guard, wait in half guard, and just sort of stand around. Like, he's getting stuff done while he's on the mat, and he's a joy to watch when he does grapple. I do worry about him a little bit at this weight class, though, because it does feel like the weight cuts are starting to catch up to Matt Schnell a little bit. He hasn't looked good his last couple of times, making 125, and I do worry, because it's weird. He's not going to be the bigger guy in this matchup against Royval, but I do feel like Royval can make this weight a little bit more comfortably than Matt Schnell can. That might not be the whole story of the fight. It might not matter at all. I just feel like it's something that we should bring up here. But I wonder, who do you think goes for the first takedown in this fight? Because these guys do match up very well. They're both good strikers. They're both good grapplers. I just wonder who wants to take this fight to the ground first. Because for Royval, he's much more kill or be killed, be it on the feet or on the mat. He'll give up good positions just to go for a submission sometime. Whereas Schnell, I know I talk about him going for a lot more submissions, but he's a little bit more methodical with how he goes about it. He'll win more minutes and less moments. So I'm curious, who do you think decides to go to their grappling first?
It's probably going to be Matt Schnell. And the weird part about it is you bring up the weigh-ins and so on and so forth. Matt Schnell was booked to fight Alex Perez 4 different times last year. Perez had a hard time making weight, and especially the last time out. So credit to Matt Schnell for making the weight right there. Fighter pay notwithstanding, he had a good leg to stand on after that. And now he ends up with Brandon Royval. And again, training out of Fortis MMA, Heritage Muay Thai, Gracie Baja West Chase, like so many different ones. But again, I would think that Chanel's probably going to want to initiate the grappling a little bit sooner just because of how big of a wild card Brandon Royval is when he stands. And the fact that he's got power in such unorthodox ways. Go back to Brandon Royval's fight against Kai Kara-France if you want to see a wild, wild type of fight that way. But yeah, for me, it's a very, very good fight. It's a very, very tough fight to predict. And again, this one isn't a normal Fight Night Picks type of prediction. I'm going to take it a different way. I look at the odds, and Brandon Royval right now, minus 260 favorite, Matt Schnell at a plus 208. I would have thought those odds would be a lot closer than they are right now.
Did you? This is the thing about Matt Schnell. I just feel like the story's kind of out on him at this point. If you can hit him clean on the feet, you can win. And in the grappling, I do think it could be close between these guys. And I think you're right. I do think Schnell's probably the more likely to go for a takedown because Royval can be held down, and Schnell does have a really good top position. I think on the feet, though, Schnell's going to be in a lot of trouble from the first minute of the fight to the last minute of the fight. And I couldn't imagine watching Brandon Royval fight Tim Elliott and think, wow, I should take that guy down really quick. Because Royval's so fast at cinching up his defensive submissions, got a great guillotine, really good with the scrambles, too. The only problem is, when he fights that top level of scrambler like a Brandon Moreno, we kind of saw what happened in their fight. I know he got his arm dislocated, but even before that, Moreno went from full guard to mount to back in about half a second on Royval, so I think these guys match up really, really well. I just think on the feet, Schnell's going to be in danger in every minute of this fight, whereas Royval, I think, can eat the power of Schnell quite a bit more, and I think he can take a lot more chances in this fight.
Well, we have a look at those odds. Again, you do have Royval as a sizable favorite over Schnell, and if we have a look at Tapology, the votes are a surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Royval.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. It's way over. 694 total votes, 91% Royval, 36% by decision, 49% by submission for the 9% that have Schnell, 62% by decision. So Brandon Royval by submission or Matt Schnell by decision. That's what the fans are saying. You're leaning Royval's way in this one, eh?
I am, but this is one of those rare flyweight fights where both guys could win by finish in any single way. Like, that's how talented both of these fighters are. Again, I know I've set this up a little bit more pro Brandon Royval, but I can't speak enough about the skills of Matt Schnell. He is technically sound in every single area of every fight. If you go back to the Tyson Nam fight, like, stylistically, that's kind of a tough fight for Matt Schnell. He does struggle with power punchers on the feet. We know how good Nam is with his outside movement, but Schnell looked really good in that fight. I know it was a split decision, but I thought Schnell won that fight quite comfortably, and I thought he looked really good with his own boxing. I just worry about his durability compared to Royval's. I've seen Royval eat some really big shots in the UFC, and he might go down from them, but at least he gets back up, whereas Schnell, when he gets hit, does struggle to recover after that initial wobble, and I do think Royval could take advantage after that and finish him, be it with a submission or with some ground and pound on the ground.
Traditionally, a bit of a higher work rate from Matt Schnell in his much longer UFC tenure, and again, when it comes to the takedowns, who's going to initiate first, that really will be the fun thing to see. So I'm going to take this one off. I'm going to make it a pop and popcorn and pick Brandon Royval to get the win, because again, I think out of that southpaw stance, he makes things very, very tricky, especially on some of those Schnell entries, whether it be with the defensive submission abilities, but also when he can time a counter or time something on that way in. Great opportunity for Royval. So both of us going with Factory X's own Brandon Royval to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Some big time fights left on this card that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Couple of fighters whose last fights were at featherweight. Competing at featherweight, we have Macy Chasson taking on the immortal Norma Dumont. For Norma Dumont, coming off of her big time main event win that happened in the UFC over Aspen Ladd, victorious on judges' scorecards by scores of 49-46, and maybe there was a 48-47 in there somewhere. But for Dumont, great activity on the feet in that one. Maybe Ladd was a little bit shook with her confidence. However, you got to give credit where it's due to Norma Dumont, because she comes into the UFC, she takes on Megan Anderson, and she had her, and I know we're going to talk about it today, her Jonathan Pierce, Joe Lozon-esque type of fight. Right cross drops her, she ends up getting finished. But since then, three big wins for Norma Dumont. She's looked very good in them. One over Ashley Evans-Smith, one over Felicia Spencer, and one over Aspen Ladd. And for Macy Chasson, it's been weird, right? She beats Penny Kanza to win the Ultimate Fighter. There's been high highs. There's been low lows. I would say the lowest of low, coming in her weight miss in her last fight and then losing by finish to Raquel Pennington, but also a loss to Lena Landsberg across the way over in Denmark in that one. Wins over Marion Renault, Shanny Young, and Sarah Morris, as well as Gina Mazzani in the UFC. It's just weird because Macy Chasson, for the longest time, myself included with everyone else, thought that this is a perennial top five contender in the UFC's bantamweight division, and it still could happen, but right now, you're really buying low on that. It's like Joe Anderson Brito going into his fight against Andre Feely with Craig Allen saying, hey, I like that line. I'm not picking him, but I like that line. There were three fighters on this card that I was really high on when they came into the UFC, and two of the three haven't worked out at all. Jordy Newsome, who I brought up earlier, I thought he was going to be really good, hasn't worked out. Melissa Gatto, I had really high hopes for her, and luckily she's been able to prove me right up until this point. And Macy Chasson was another one of these fighters, and I know we were both really high on her too. We love her striking, she can get it done from the outside, has great elbows on the inside. But she's one of these fighters who, the strengths are numerous, but so are the weaknesses at this point too, and it does feel like a good game plan can kind of solve the problem that is Macy, because we know how great she is on the feet. We've also seen so many defensive liabilities with her grappling at this point in the UFC that you do wonder if she is ever going to fix that hole in her game. And we were kind of joking around before we started filming this. 2 years ago, I thought Macy would beat Norma Dumont, probably by TKO, probably in the second round. It'd be one of these, like, what's the UFC even doing? Like, this is awful matchmaking. But knowing what we know now, and knowing how good Norma Dumont looks at 145 pounds, this is a really tough fight for Macy, and it's definitely an uphill battle, because, okay, what does Norma Dumont excel at? She's a phenomenal grappler, has really good submission ability, but her striking continues to get better, and she has really good Muay Thai.
Her striking's always, I mean, a Sonda black belt, and you see that in her movement on the feet.
The issue was, going off that Megan Anderson loss, though, you just didn't really know what you were going to get, but she definitely has been able to showcase that part of her game a lot more now, and you're right, that loss to Megan Anderson is one of those tough losses, like, let's just call it what it is. That's a really bad look. But if you do look at what she's been able to accomplish ever since that, I do feel like she's more than been able to make up for that bad performance. Whereas Chasson, she's kind of in the other category where it started really high, and we've just sort of been chipping away at it ever since. And her last fight against Raquel Pennington, I thought stylistically, okay, Pennington, we know how good of a grinder she is. She has good submissions. I didn't think she'd go out there and not ragdoll Macy, that's a bit of a strong term, but she thoroughly outcompeted her and really just grinded away at Macy in a way that we hadn't really seen up until that point. And that's why I do think if Norma Dumont can take the cardio that she was able to demonstrate in her last fight, a 5-round performance against Aspen Ladd, and you're right, was that the best version of Aspen Ladd we've ever seen? Probably not, but Norma Dumont could not have looked any better than she did in that fight, and I think she's going to take a lot of confidence coming off of a fight at featherweight against another top contender. I really do think we're probably going to see the best version of Norma Dumont in this fight.
Getting more work in the States at Syndicate MMA, I think that's probably a good combination for it too. So I look at the odds in this one. Again, it was a little bit of a surprise to me because what we do, breaking the fourth wall, I don't look at the odds. I do all the tape study, I do my notes up, and then right before I hit record, I go, okay, Matt, give me a second. And then I write them down individually. I was surprised. Norma Dumont opened a minus 210 favorite, minus 248 right now on best fight odds. For Macy Chasson, open a plus 180, plus 199 or thereabouts, so plus 200. We have a look over on Tapology. Now, this is the part that is a surprise to us, it is to you. I'm going to say over under 75% Dumont.
I was going to say 80% Dumont, so.
It is over, so 702 total votes, 88% Dumont, 87% by decision for the 12% that have Chasson, 74% by decision. So a lot of people seeing a decision here. I think it'll also go to a decision in this one. But if you really like Macy Chasson, this is the opportunity to buy incredibly low where she's almost a 2-1 underdog. For me, though, I do like Norma Dumont. The activity on the feet and her foot movement and placement. She's so very good at striking any which way when she's in the cage. So we talked about it. Christophe Jacquot against Gerald Meerschaert. Norma Dumont fighting anybody. Very good on the back foot, very good at circling. When Norma Dumont decides to put on her own pressure, very good, and defensively a good striker. So again,
There are positions where Chiasson could take over. You love her clinch game. You love the elbows. You love the knees. Even when she has her back up against the fence, she can get good when she gets her plum clinch in. But for me, I do like Norma Dumont in this fight. A little bit more well-rounded of a skill set. I'm eager to see how Chiasson makes out on the scales as well, because not that it was an issue before, but a big red flag that she ended up missing at 145 her last time out.
This is the weird thing about Norma Dumont. I just don't know what she's building towards. You know? Like, at 145...
A Chris Cyborg fight.
Exactly. We're talking about her fighting someone from an organization that's not the UFC. Like, isn't it weird how she's the only kind of contender at 145 pounds right now? I'm good with it, too. It's just... Normally, and I know there's a lot of fans out there who do the same thing. You get done watching a fight and you immediately go, okay, well, what's next? Who could they fight in the future? Norma Dumont's looked really good as of late, but I've never got done watching one of her fights and thought, wow, this is an obvious next opponent for her. I know Amanda Nunes is going to have her rematch for the title at 135, and she's still the featherweight champion, but the division is kind of put on ice right now, other than the fact that Norma Dumont's been consistent as of late. So it was just nice to be able to see, okay, if Dumont wins this fight, this is next for her. I believe she will be able to win it, but it was just nice to be able to set some kind of a road forward so we know what this is building towards.
There's one other featherweight fighter on the UFC's roster, because again, Felicia Spencer retired. There's 1-0 Danielle Wolfe. So
she's
both
not
of us
fighting Norma Dumont.
Going with Norma Dumont to get the win over Macy Chiasson this weekend. Maybe she fights 1-0 Danielle Wolfe. Maybe she fights for the title later on this year. Who the hell knows? But a big time fight nonetheless, and a big time main card coming up that you're not going to want to miss. So you got to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Coming, Rude Boy Boy, can you give it up?
Oh, no.
Love me, love me. Rude Boy Randy Brown coming up this weekend, taking on the Ox fighter, Chaos Kalen Williams, a guy whose name I could not figure out when he made his UFC debut. But what I do know is he was able to rack off very quick wins over Alex Morono, where he's a +300 underdog. He beats Abdulrazak Al-Hassan. He picks up an L on his record, but we can just gloss over that because it's been two wins since that point in time. And for Chaos Williams, it is an interesting career because... we've seen these adjustments since he's been in the UFC where he comes in, gets those big knockout wins, loses to Michel Pereira in a fight where both guys were technical and tentative.
Is that the Elysio Zaleski Dos Santos versus Muslim Salikov fight of his career? We all had such high hopes for that performance, and then they just stood there and looked at each other for 15 minutes.
Well, then Chaos has a really close fight against Matt Semelsberger, wins that one by decision. You could have made an argument either way. And then he knocks out Miguel Baeza, and that's a thing that happens more often now, but it started really with Chaos getting the job done. So for Chaos Williams, he's coming into a fight against Randy Brown, who's rolling. And when Randy came into the UFC, it was really hard to tell what kind of a guy you were going to get. He was a Dana White's looking for a fight guy. You might completely forget that, but that's where he came from. And it's been a really interesting and impactful UFC career because... I remember way back when he took on Matt Dwyer in the UFC debut. Matt Dwyer, fellow Canadian, you know, UFC Moncton, Canadian. But realistically, he gets a win there, and then it's kind of off to the races. And I look at the losses, one to Mike Graves, one to Bilal Muhammad, one to Nico Price, one to Vicente Luque. And all of those losses you can somewhat understand. And with Randy Brown, I mean, what's the Achilles heel? He doesn't check leg kicks, and he has very thin legs, and they get kicked a lot. His wrestling defense isn't great, but it's not bad, and I'd say that's probably really it with him.
He holds his chin a little high. That is the one thing. This is my theory, and it's been this has held true ever since I brought it up on the channel, so I can keep on saying it. Tall people make a mistake in sparring just by being tall. This is the problem. When you're taller than people in sparring, all I have to do is lean back. That's all you have to do. People aren't going to continue with their combinations because you're not trying to knock your opponent out in sparring.
Hopefully.
But you normally aren't trying to if you're with a sparring partner that you know. Like, it rarely happens. People don't get knocked out in sparring ever, really. Randy Brown leans back a lot, and he does leave his head wide open a lot in his fights. And he's one of these weird fighters, so you're right. He kind of looks good at all of his losses, but it does feel like there's always a tricky spot in all of his wins where you're like, ugh, it'd be nice if he didn't have to go through that adversity on his way to a win. So he is kind of a tricky fighter. This is the thing I'll say about Randy Brown, though. Athletically, he has every intangible you would want for a welterweight fighter. He's extremely physically strong, has really, really long arms, so he has great range, great reach, and he is a cerebral fighter. You're right. He is a great offensive grappler, does struggle a little bit with his own wrestling defense, but for the most part, when it's time to strike and when it's time to grapple, Randy Brown is really good with his ranges. It's just he does get caught quite a bit. And you bring up the level of competition that Randy Brown has had. Not even close between these guys over the last few years. And it's kind of funny. We talk so much about Chaos Williams' level of competition coming into the UFC. How, listen, they're good wins, but they're over a lot of people he probably should have won. We can't really say that anymore, especially after the UFC run he's been able to have. He's proven me wrong more times than I can count at this point. It's been really nice to see because Williams can show you that, hey, do I have to be the most technical guy? No. If you have power like Chaos Williams has power, it erases a lot of your sins that you make throughout your fights. This is the weird thing about this fight, though. Just in my mind, I assume, oh, Randy Brown, a way better grappler than Chaos Williams. Chaos himself is a decent wrestler, though, and that's why I am curious to see. Can Williams keep this fight on the feet? Because I think his physical strength is going to help him keep it on the feet for at least a little while early on in the fight. I think Rude Boy is the better gas tank, and I do think that his experience against higher level fighters is going to help him a lot in this matchup, because you went through a couple of his opponents. Isn't this crazy? He went from fighting Bilal Muhammad to Mickey Gall. Like, those were back-to-back opponents for Randy Brown. That's a crazy difference between those two.
So if you go back and you look at it for Chaos Williams, for parity's sake, in 2018, he was 3-0 and he lost to a debuting Dan Yates. Dan Yates, who's 1-1 in his overall
Mr.
MMA
genuine.
Career. So 2018, very early on that year. Who was Randy Brown taking on at that point in time? Well, he beat Mickey Gall in November 2017, and then in July of 2018, he lost to Nico Price, the embarrassing hammer fist off the bottom. So again, you're taking on Gall, Price, after that wins over Barbarena, Alves, lost to Luque, beats Alex Oliveira with a crazy one-arm rear naked choke, and then beats Jared Gooden. Is he ex-MMA zone now? He's been around.
He is.
Jared Gooden. I enjoy a Jared Gooden fight. But Chaos Williams, again, he's proven it that he's more than just that. On the regional scene, he was a good wrestler. But again, I worry about it against Randy Brown because Randy Brown's jiu-jitsu is very, very good. So we look at the odds for this fight. Brown open to minus 125. He's a plus 111 underdog at this point. We look at it for Chaos Williams, open to plus 105. He is a minus 135 favorite. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over under 65% Chaos Williams.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. It is over. 694 total votes. Wow. 74% Williams, 87% by knockout. For the 26% that are Brown, 67% by decision. Matt, these guys are... Somebody that's been, like, high listening to the show, I just freaked them out and ruined their night by knocking on the shelf behind us. But, Matt, when we're looking at this one, you know, these guys are knocking on the top 15. They're probably, what, in that 25 to 20 category, somewhere in there? There's a lot of names in that category, by the way. But who do you have?
More than five, you'd say?
More than five, more than 10. I have so many people in that top 25 to 20. But when we're looking at this fight, I mean, who are you picking here?
Chaos Williams, okay, if you've ever hit one of those punching machines, Chaos Williams has the record on the one that you've hit. I don't care where it is and what corner of the earth.
Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, you bet.
Chaos Williams has set the record in all of them, each and every one. No one's ever beat him before in them, and you cannot prove me otherwise. This is a weird fight, because again, if you stack up their skills, Randy Brown's the more skilled fighter, and normally I would pick the more skilled fighter, but I do feel like the combination of Williams' takedown defense and his power punching, he's going to hit Randy Brown with a clean shot at one point, and this is what I meant when I talked about Randy Brown sometimes looks good in bad performances and bad in good performances. Against Nico Price, he looked pretty good early on in that fight. He out-wrestled Nico Price, like, he got to that top position, and then Nico Price had done something we had never seen before. Go back to the Alex Oliveira fight. I didn't love Randy Brown's fighting in the first 4 minutes or so of that round. I know he won by first round rear naked choke, so it's hard to take any negatives from that performance, but he ate a ton of leg kicks, and he ate some straight shots at range too, and Alex Oliveira can't really make you pay with those strikes. Chaos Williams certainly can, though, and I think that's why I'm going to side towards Chaos Williams for this fight, but we were talking about this before. This could have been on the Fight of the Night screen without a doubt.
Oh, 100%. Chaos Williams throws a lot of kicks, and he kind of plants on his left foot, throws the kick, and then resets. That's a huge opportunity for the longer fighter and Randy Brown to either take him down or to hit him. So for me, again, Randy Brown gets kicked quite a bit, gets kicked to his legs to where it's troubling. But again, I gotta go with the more skilled guy over the power. And this is legendary power. This is like face-melting Johnny Hendricks in 2013 type of power that we're dealing with in this division.
What we're trying to say is you don't want to get hit clean by Chaos Williams.
No, I don't. I certainly don't. But I do not have him in this one. I've got Randy Brown based on all of the skills that we talked about earlier on. But again, the vaporizing power of Chaos Williams. How many adjectives can I add on to the power? We could be here all day. We're split on the pick. I'm going to go with the man representing Jamaica. He has multiple Airbnbs there. I heard that in an interview that he did with James Lynch not that long ago.
Look us up, Randy Brown.
To learn that Randy Brown's not training at Kings MMA for this fight. Matt's going with Chaos Williams. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. It's a great fight at welterweight. Yeah. And we have a giant main card coming up that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, with 33 performance bonuses among them and a combined age of 77, we have Donald Cowboy Cerrone taking on the coach that is Joe Lauzon. You could say that about either one of these guys. For Donald Cerrone, he has the BMF Ranch. I've seen a lot of fighters go there recently. Daniel Rodriguez, a longtime guy there. Cameron Els, that's been in the UFC.
Yeah, Rodriguez has made some stops throughout the years.
You've also had Sasha Platnikov and Cerrone for this camp. Little bit there, little bit with those guys at Syndicate MMA. Taking on Joe Lauzon out of, well, Lauzon's mixed martial arts. And a lot of fighters that have gone through that door as well lately. But a really weird point in these guys' career, because I talk about it in terms of the bonuses, and they have won so many of them. For Cerrone, his last bonus against Tony Ferguson, a fight of the night where he blew his nose and his eyeball puffed up and he looked like an old miner from the 1800s. Before that, bonuses over or against Ally Quinta, fight of the night. Fight of the night performance bonus against Alex Hernandez and a performance bonus over Mike Perry. And if you look at it for Joe Lauzon, his last performance bonuses or bonus in general was a fight of the night against Jim Miller in 2016. Obviously, we know where these guys are right now because Cerrone, a little bit older. Joe Lauzon hasn't been fighting as much.
A little bit older.
Hasn't been fighting as much as Joe Lauzon. However, Joe Lauzon had a fight against Jonathan Pierce that just ages so well. And for Jonathan Pierce, he's bucked it. Like, he's past it now, but that was Lauzon's last fight. So he can still rest on those laurels. It's just odd to see this fight right now in 2022 where Cowboy Cerrone, I can, you know, use a cheesy term and say, okay, well, this guy's a gunslinger. And you would agree with me, you know.
He's about this life, though, 100%. Like, when you think about an MMA fighter in his day-to-day life and in the cage, you probably have an idea of someone like Cowboy Cerrone. He's riding horses. He's on, like, doing jet skis and stuff. Like, Cowboy does wild stuff in his spare time. Goes skydiving. He hunts a lot. Like, Cowboy is what his nickname is. And it's been really nice to see. And I do agree with you. It's weird to see these guys fight each other in 2022. But I wouldn't want to see them with anyone else as an opponent at this stage of their careers.
Yeah, like Cowboy Cerrone goes in, fills out a personality test. And they ask you, like, what do you do in your spare time? And Matt Allen would say, for his response, probably, doing jet skis.
But he's always up to something. And
he's that little rascal.
But that's the, like, both of these guys are in a really good spot in the sport, and I hope they realize it themselves, because I don't look at Joe Lauzon and Cowboy Cerrone as two people who, they gotta fight deep into their 40s because there's nothing else for them to do. Like, Joe Lauzon, like you said, it's not like Lauzon MMA is this new thing that just started a year ago and we're not sure if it's gonna make it or not. Like, Joe Lauzon's an exceptional coach who has a lot of respect in the sport, who's maybe not globally known, but if you know anything about MMA, you probably know quite a bit about Joe Lauzon. And same thing with Cowboy Cerrone. So I hope that these guys don't have to take a lot of fights after this one, because I really do feel like the matchmaking for this is going to result in a fun fight. Because this was a point I had a lot about Joe Lauzon, especially after the Gritzmacher fight, because that was an awful loss.
Oh yeah, knockout loss right there.
But it wasn't just a knockout loss. There's different ways to get knocked out. Like, Conor McGregor's knockout win over Jose Aldo isn't as bad as how bad Lauzon looked against Gritzmacher. There was no response. And that's what I talked about. Like, Darren Elkins, that was a big point for me last weekend. He looked really good and got the win. But fighters reach a stage in their career where they get hit and they just don't throw back. BJ Penn was at that point in his career near the end. It was, okay, I'm not getting knocked out. I'm not getting flatlined. But you could tell that once he got hurt, he could just never really recover from that point. But what I do like out of Lauzon is he's taken a lot of time off since that fight and he hasn't been as active. And I'm really glad you brought that up at the beginning, because for Cowboy, In the Morono fight, he kind of looked like the fighter that I claimed Joe Lozon was in the Grützmacher fight. Cowboy didn't get flatlined or anything in that fight against Morono. He got hit by a clean kick, and then you could tell the second he was wobbled, he kind of shelled up. It's just, he fought in a much more defensive way. And when you're fighting a guy like Joe Lozon, who has, I'll be honest, an odd amount of explosion in his punches. Like, he does have decent punching power. He throws weird shovel hooks.
Yeah, he comes forward into it. Like, it is, it's different.
Go back and watch his knockout win over Jens Pulver. This is the weirdest thing about Joe Lozon. He knocked out Jens Pulver and then said, okay, I'll take a step back and Ultimate Fighter, and I'll let Jens Pulver be my coach, even though I just got a win over him. Like, Joe Lozon is a mixed martial artist through and through. Like, he just wants to learn more about the sport as he goes on. If he gets some wins along the way, that's pretty cool. If he loses some along the way, that's pretty cool too. Just what I want people who are watching this fight and this video to know is that we might not be watching prime Donald Cerrone or prime Joe Lozon, but I'll be damned if I let either one of these guys be disrespected this week and let people talk bad about them for how they've looked as of late. Because if you know anything about this sport, and if you are a hardcore MMA fan, you've got nothing but love for Cowboy Cerrone and for Joe Lozon.
Cowboy Cerrone opened a minus 300 favorite for this fight. He's a minus 180 right now. Joe Lozon opened at a plus 250. Plus 150 right now. Topology vote, surprise to us, Sarah. To you, I'm going to say over under 80% Cowboy Cerrone.
I think even higher.
It's slightly lower. 700 and what is it? 89 total votes. 63% Cerrone, 70% by decision. For the 37% that have Lozon, 41% by decision, 34% by the knockout. So, Matt, it is a very interesting fight. Cerrone in the last five fights, Justin Gaethje, you've got Conor McGregor, Anthony Pettis, Nico Price, and Alex Morono.
And those, Tony right before that, too.
Those last two are at 170 pounds. But this fight's at lightweight, and Cerrone looks like death on the scales at 155.
And, that was going to be the last thing I wanted to hit it to. I like the fact that Lozon's making Cowboy come down to his weight class and not moving up, because I feel like this fight would have originally planned for, hey, you guys are both about to retire, how about we don't cut weight, we both fight at welterweight? If that was the case, I would say Cowboy Cerrone without a doubt. He's the much bigger guy naturally, and I do think this weight cut down to 155 is very, very tough for him at this stage of his career. Like, he moved up to 170 in 2016. That was a while ago. Like, 2016 wasn't 2 years ago anymore. That was 6 years ago now that he decided, I can't make that weight and I need to enter a new weight class. And that's why I can't pick Cowboy Cerrone with 100% confidence. I'm still going to pick him in this fight because I do feel like the results for him on the feet are a lot more concussive than Joe Lozon. I know Lozon has surprising punching power, but Cowboy still has good kicks on the outside. He still has weapons on the feet that are going to damage Lozon over time. But if the weight cut is tough on Cowboy, and I think we all think it will be, I could see a lot of worlds where Joe Lozon gets him to the ground, maybe looks really good, but I'm still going to pick Cowboy.
Yeah, I think Joe Lozon absolutely grinds him out and makes this a Joe Lozon fight.
And Cowboy just beat RDA in a straight, like, submission grappling thing. So I do think he's focused a lot on his grappling as of late.
That was in 2020. And then he lost to Craig Jones, and he lost to Joe Selecki, who's a big 155.
Craig Jones, the best grappler in the world?
And again, you see where I set it up? Joe Selecki.
I'm just saying, the fact that he's focused a lot on his grappling during this time off, I think will help him a lot in this matchup with Lozon.
To me, I look at it like Jessica Ai going to grappling tournaments. She's losing and then also not grappling well in
MMA. Cowboy has tons of submission wins on his record, though.
I know he does. I'm aware of that.
Jessica Ai's not a good MMA grappler, though. Cowboy is a good one.
And Joe Lozon's a better one.
I don't know if it's so cut and dry like that. Like, Cowboy, I don't think, is just doing submission tournaments to pass the time. Like, he genuinely has a ton of submission wins at the UFC level.
Yeah, no, and he's 39. Jessica. We're split on the pick. I've got Joe Lozon, who was a heavy underdog at the start. Now the odds are closing in. You got Donald Cowboy Cerrone to get off that losing streak and gain a dub inside of the cage. Big time fight coming up this weekend. It's contentious with us. You let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this premier fight and in this weight class. Title on the line, Charles Oliveira taking on Justin Gaethje in that main event. I can't wait for it. I know you're excited about it too. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Big time rematch scheduled for this weekend, and this one is years in the making. Their first fight was at UFC Fight Night 56 in a main event of, and I want to make sure that I get this one right, in Uberlandia in Brazil, and it was Ovince St. Preux finishing Mauricio Shogun Rua inside of a round with a check left hook on the back foot, which is something that we see very often out of Vince St. Preux. Shogun Hua going down, St. Preux hammering away, and they were scheduled to rematch a few years later, but it was unfortunate the fight did not happen. But that first one, November 8th, 2014. I was in university back then, Matt. Where were you in 2014? Still in high school.
I was a grade 10 at the time, yeah.
Still in high school. So it's wild to think that these two guys are rematching this far away in the future. And it's really been mixed results for these guys, not even since then, but just lately. And for Shogun, the 5-on-in is spread apart through years. It's 3 years and 8 months ago. He took on Anthony Smith in a main event across the pond where he walked in crying and he walked out losing very quickly to Anthony Smith. Picks up a big win over Tyson Pedro, the shock to many. He has a crazy fight against Paul Craig that ends up as a split draw. He then has a fight against Antonio Rogério Nogueira that he wins by split decision in one of the worst fights I've ever seen. It was awful. And then his next time out, he fights Paul Craig in the rematch, goes out there, has some of those quick blitzes that we knew in his time over with Pride in his early time with the UFC. But for Shogun, he gets completely out-grappled and out-wrestled in the first round of that. He does have some explosivity to get back up. There is a point, though, up against the cage where you see Paul Craig getting the back. And Shogun, when he gets taken down in this attempt, he hits the canvas, he winces really bad, and then with his right arm, he kind of like goes to push on the ground and pulls it back and winces even more. Like, it looked like he got hurt. Gets back up, but then in the second round, some more explosion, gets taken down, back mounted, flattened out, Paul Craig hammering away, Herb Dean watching, and then Shogun tapping due to strikes, and that was just something that you didn't want to see. Taking on OSP, who, yes, he's been finished, yes, he's fought at heavyweight lately. The Tanner Boser fight, he did absolutely nothing in the first round of that fight. He got backed up, did not strike, did not counter, had nothing. His coach said, okay, now you got him tired. You got to start doing something. And then OSP has that great, like, almost judo throw to get the takedown. Boser grabs the fence as he's getting up. Jason Herzog says, don't do that, but didn't change anything. Boser gets back up, hammers away, knocks down and out OSP. But now we're here. Ovince was getting ready for a fight at light heavyweight for that one. He weighed in at 230 against Boser. He was, what, like 240 when he fought Ben Rothwell at heavyweight. I don't see these guys, you know, having giant, giant issues on the scale. But again, 40-year-old Shogun and 39-year-old OSP. Who'd have thought?
So do you want me to start with the weight?
I don't know.
Here's the thing about this fight. If OSP can make 205 healthy and safely, I don't know how he loses this. We're all being honest with each other. Here's the problem with Mauricio Shogun Hua's career, and no one loves this man more than me. Again, every time we talk about him, we just talk about how this is one of the guys who got us involved in MMA. We watched him growing up. His career in hindsight doesn't look that great. Like, Shogun only had one 3-fight winning streak in the UFC in his whole entire career. And when you do look at it, it was in, like, a weird stage where he beat Jean Valente to end it. Like, he's been riding a lot off that Pride tournament win back in 2006, and we all talk, 2005, we all talk about it all the time, and it was a great showcase, but he hasn't had a 4-fight win streak since then. And if we do look at Shogun as an all-time great, which I do think he is based on accomplishment, it is really hard to look at his record and think, wow, he was on like this one run that really puts him up there with the best of anyone. Like, it's kind of like Charles Oliveira. Charles Oliveira at the start of his career, not an all-time great at all. But if you just isolate the run he's on right now, no one can deny the fact that he is currently on an all-time great run. For Shogun, he was just never on one of those. And that's why it is hard to always go back and think, well, was he really at that world-class level? Like, he was even an underdog fighting John Jones when John Jones was only 21 years old fighting for the title back in the day. So people back then had even sort of tapered their expectations for what Shogun was. And I just feel like it's been a very, very long time since he's had a quality win against someone who was able to maintain in the UFC. Like, we're going through his record right now. Brandon Vera did not have the best run in the UFC. I know he's getting one championship, but still, and the UFC wasn't great. James Tahuna. It's a good win, but when you look at the losses around it, lost to Chael, lost to Dan Henderson, lost to OSP, he's beating guys he should beat, and he's losing to the more recognizable names at the top of this division. And even as of late, you bring up his win over Nogueira, it's a good point. A split decision win in a low output fight against someone like Nogueira, that doesn't give me a lot of confidence going into a fight against OSP, who definitely isn't in the prime of his career anymore. But does OSP eat one shot and go down? Okay, maybe he doesn't need a lot of shots before he goes down, but he can at least need a couple power shots and respond with his own in a fight. I don't know if Shogun has that level of durability anymore, and the other thing is, OSP is a way better grappler than a lot of people realize, and yes, people are starting to get on board now. They know him for that St. Preux choke, because it's not even the Von Flu anymore. Everyone knows OSP for doing it. I think he's the better grappler. I think he's the bigger fighter. I think he's the more athletic fighter. I just don't know what Shogun's going to do to win this fight at 40 years of age.
To me, again, even in that last Paul Craig fight, Shogun still had that quick first step, that good blitz that you know him for, those... Like, who sizes Shogun's trunks throughout his career? They're the smallest damn trunks I've ever seen in my life. And into his 40s, he's still wearing these friggin'... Get longer shorts, man! It's embarrassing.
Like, he's a big Larry Bird fan.
OSP wears those long, like, compression shorts that go almost down to his knees. Shogun needs those, because they're boy shorts that you wear, like, on a weekend away. And Shogun's wearing them as a 40-year-old! And I'm not wearing them. I'm just saying. I take issue with them. They're very small. But for Shogun, he still has that very quick first step. He still has that good blitz. And then he backs up and then he goes again. And against OSP, you have those counters. Could Shogun damage St. Preux? Possibly. But he doesn't have that same oomph at the end of his shots. And again, Shogun's issues lately in these losses are his defensive wrestling. It's been a problem throughout his career. We'll see if OSP goes after some of those shots, but you look at it in terms of the odds. St. Preux open a minus 160 favorite, minus 250 right now. Shogun open plus 140, plus 200. We have a look over in Topology. This is a childhood idol, and I hate to say it, but over under 75% will win St. Preux.
I think it'll be an 85 or above.
75 on the nose. So 779 total votes, 75% St. Preux, 31% by decision, 64% by knockout for the 25% that have Shogun, 39% by decision, 47% by knockout. I think that Ovince St. Preux wins this fight, and it's going to be sad for me in 2022 as it would have been in like 2007.
I think OSP stops Shogun, probably with a big kick, too. That's the problem. On the outside, OSP has crazy power with his kicks. I know we haven't seen it a lot as of late because he's fighting heavyweights who can kind of wear on him with their physicality, so they're not giving him the range to set up with his own kicks. Shogun likes to stand at that kickboxing Muay Thai range and try to get off his own leg kicks. If you stand at kicking range with OSP, it's one of the worst ideas you can possibly have. Like, he broke John Jones' arm with a kick. That's a pretty big deal. No, sorry. He got his own arm broken against John Jones in that fight. I should clarify that. But his kicks were really good to the body and to the arms. And that's the thing that I do focus on a lot. Even if Shogun's blocking these kicks to the body and to the head, I still think they are going to damage him as the fight goes on. Whereas, unless Preux eats a big flurry up against the cage, I think he'll be the steadier fighter. And again, I like St. Preux by finishing this. And it hurts to say that when I'm talking about Shogun Hua.
Shogun, in the first round of these fights, like 35 years of age plus, in the second round of his fights, he looks completely gassed in the second round. He's breathing heavy, flat-footed, loses the explosivity. So if he wins, it would surprise me this weekend. I also have Ovince St. Preux coming up. Maybe it's not going to be in like 30 or 40 seconds like the first fight, but I do have St. Preux to win by finish this weekend. So let us know down below in the comment section. Are we completely off base on this one? Do you have the 2005 Pride Grand Prix Championship winner who finished Alistair Overeem back then? Or do you have the man himself now representing Extreme Couture in Ovince St. Preux? Big time fight on this main card. Three big ones left that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Big time fight coming up on our UFC 274 main card at lightweight. We have the former 12 fight in a row winner, El Cucuy Tony Ferguson, taking on the former three-time Bellator lightweight champ, Iron Michael Chandler. For Tony Ferguson, I want to stress the importance of that 12-fight win streak because we've only seen win streaks one fight longer in the UFC. Listen, John Jones, Demetrius Johnson, who else? Habib, they had a 13-fight win streak. GSP had a 13-fight win streak. Like, we haven't seen many guys or fighters in general have win streaks that long before, and that is the list and the type of air that Tony Ferguson was in. Now, again, he has lost three in a row. Justin Gaethje in there. Then you have Benil Dariush. You also have Charles Oliveira. All of those three kind of going in different ways, except for the last two, because realistically, you look at it in the fight against Justin Gaethje, blood and guts, absolutely an amazing fight, and it's Gaethje just with an accumulation of damage. It's the reason that got him to the dance. He's able to get that win over Ferguson and really, really pour it on him. Then you look at the last two fights. The Charles Oliveira fight where, in the first round, Oliveira is able to get 3 minutes and 35 seconds of control. Second round, 4 minutes and 5 seconds of control. Third round, 3 minutes 59 seconds of control. Was the book out on Tony Ferguson after that one? Because Beneil Dariush goes out. First round, 3 minutes and 40 seconds. Second round, 4 minutes and 4 seconds. Third round, 4 minutes and 31 seconds of control time.
This was Tony Ferguson's arm when he fought Charles Oliveira. It wasn't just bent back in an armbar. I thought his arm was getting snapped off. Like, remember when Habib fought Michael Johnson? And Joe Rogan's like, please, for the love of God, Michael Johnson, tap. He's gonna break your arm. That was the level of armbar that Tony Ferguson was put into. And he still somehow had, like, the heart to be like, yeah, I'm cool with basically losing my right arm for the rest of this fight. Just Tony Ferguson, win, lose, or draw, isn't gonna give up on himself.
No, and it's crazy to see that. And again, Ferguson at this point in his career is obviously a different fighter than he was 3 or 4 years ago. But even at 38, it'll be interesting to see what version we do get of him, considering the fight against Beneil Dariush was 11 months ago. And for Michael Chandler, again, this is a guy that made his UFC debut 1 year and 3 months ago. Performance of the night bonus and a title shot earned off his victory over Dan Hooker. We all know that overhand. A loss to Charles Oliveira about 11 months ago where that was a crazy fight. I mean, he almost had Oliveira finish in the first round. And then his last fight against Justin Gaethje about 5 months ago, a fight of the year. And we're going to talk a lot about Justin Gaethje because he's arguably had 3 fight of the years since he's been with UFC, debuting in 2017. But Michael Chandler, you might have thought, okay, well, this guy's like late in his career. He's coming over into the UFC. What kind of an impact can he make now? Because even back in 2019, he got finished pretty quickly by Patricio Pitbull, who's once again your Bellator featherweight champ. But I look at this guy as Michael Chandler. Yes, I know he just turned 36 years old last week. But to me, it still feels like he still has something left in the tank against these top 15 guys at lightweight.
I agree with that 100%. It just feels like his level of competition has improved over time because he was beating good guys in Bellator. I'm not here to tell you he wasn't. But after, like, the Eddie Alvarez, Will Brooks sort of category in Bellator, he was fighting guys who, for the most part, you felt like he was going to be able to beat before the fight happened. I know he lost to Brent Primus. There was that weird nerve injury. But if you watch the rematch of their fight, you can kind of see how that first fight was probably going to go. Michael Chandler kind of Habibs him, just gets on top of him, ground and pounds him pretty much for 25 minutes, wins a very dominant decision win over him in the rematch. But I just feel like the last two guys we've fought in Justin Gaethje and Charles Oliveira, well, they're fighting for the UFC title. They are very, very good at this sport. But Chandler made a great account of himself in both of those performances. Like you said, had Charles Oliveira in all sorts of trouble in the first round of his fight. But let's kind of be fair to Oliveira. The fight doesn't start until he gets dropped and gets back up to his feet. That's when Charles Oliveira really enters his own matrix. But for Chandler, he still has the explosion that he had pre-UFC. He still has incredible punching power. He's just a really interesting fighter because he's so offensively oriented. And I do feel like against these upper echelon strikers, I know Gaethje and Oliveira strike in a very different way, and trust me, we have many minutes worth of that to talk about later on, but they're still very technical with the way that they strike. Gaethje was able to drop Michael Chandler with a beautifully placed uppercut up the middle because he was able to read Michael Chandler's defense and figure out, okay, this guy's ducking when I'm throwing my lead hook. If I feint the hook, throw the uppercut, he's going to go right into it. Very smart by Justin Gaethje. Charles Oliveira, what was he able to do? This guy's dropping his hands, loading up, throwing a lot of overhands. If I just be technical down the middle, I'm going to be able to clip him with a hook. And guess what happened against Michael Chandler in that fight? Gets clipped and gets dropped. It was so weird to me after Chandler's fight with Oliveira because we had both predicted he was going to beat Dan Hooker and we both predicted he was going to lose to Oliveira. And a bunch of people came after us like, oh, there's no way you thought Michael Chandler was going to get knocked out. If you've watched him throughout his career, the only weakness in his game, and I truly mean the only weakness in his game, is his durability is not at like 10 out of 10. He doesn't have a glass chin. He's not a fighter who gives up in fights. He can just get hurt though. And it'll be interesting to see if Tony Ferguson can hurt Michael Chandler because Ferguson has really good punching power. I just don't feel like we've been able to see it a lot throughout his fights. There's some examples. Look at how he was able to jab up some of his opponents in the earlier stage of his career. Cowboy's a good example. It's just sustained damage throughout the fight. And even go to the Justin Gaethje matchup. He dropped Gaethje with a really nice uppercut in the second round of their fight. And I understand Tony Ferguson ate a lifetime's worth of damage in that matchup, but there were still some isolated instances where he was landing really big power shots on Justin Gaethje. And I think Gaethje's quite a bit more durable than Michael Chandler, so I do think there's a window where Ferguson hits Chandler with a big shot on the feet, maybe wobbles him and could submit him on the ground, but this fight stylistically is so much fun.
It's a weird one because, I mean, you talk about Michael Chandler, and what does he tend to do when he gets rocked? He tends to wrestle, and he gets really, really down and dirty with the wrestling, and for Tony Ferguson, if Ferguson's able to hurt Chandler and make Chandler the wrestler that we know he is, again, Division I All-American at the University of Missouri in 2009, well, then you're normally entering a world of hurt. Now, we saw Charles Oliveira completely negate that, and
he might be the best grappler we've ever seen.
Made Tony Ferguson, you know, very, very defensive off his back. And then Benil Dariush did that and turned it up a little bit. Like, it was so weird to see Tony Ferguson off his back, but not able to offer up any resistance to Dariush.
I think that's a great point. I guess this is the question I'm going to leave for you. Do you think Dariush is better or worse than Michael Chandler? And I know MMA math's hard to do, but still, Dariush and Chandler kind of fight in a similar manner. It's just Dariush doesn't have the crazy athleticism of Chandler. He's just a little bit steadier with everything that he does. So I guess for you, do you look at Benil Dariush in the grand scheme of things as ahead of Chandler in the rankings? Or would you say they're very similar fighters based on their skill sets?
I mean, Dariush rankings-wise might be a little bit higher, but when I do look at it, if I stack their skills up, Dariush is an efficient striker. His striking defense is lacking, but Michael Chandler's kind of in the same spot in some of his fights. Wrestling-wise, Chandler obviously has the edge, but grappling jiu-jitsu-wise is definitely Dariush. Now, they do things differently. When Chandler ends up on the mat, he's trying to gain position over submission, position over everything, land some ground and pound. With Dariush, he's trying to lock in submissions. So it is different. They come in different sizes, different shapes, different packages. And again, for Michael Chandler, you don't need more than that picture to tell you that this is one of the more athletic guys you're going to find in this division. Now, for the guy representing St. Louis and then Nashville and then also at the same time Sanford MMA, a tough test, obviously, against Tony Ferguson. We look at the odds in this fight, though. Chandler opened at minus 155, and then that line got cooked. And he's a minus 411 favorite right now on Bodog. Best fight odds. And then if you look at it for Tony Ferguson, open a plus 135, plus 310. I haven't looked at the Tapology vote. Surprise to me, to us, there to you.
I think Chandler by 80%.
I think it's going to be over. And slightly over. So 822 total votes, 82% Chandler, 33% by decision, 61% by knockout. For the 18% that have Tony Ferguson, it's like a lifesaver popsicle. 35% by decision, 32% by submission, 27% by knockout. So Matt, I mean, things are split. This should be a 5-round fight, but it's not. It's 3 rounds, so that could favor one of two. We'll see. But what are you saying as far as the pick's concerned here?
I don't think we've ever talked enough about Tony Ferguson's ACL. And trust me, we probably talk too much about ACLs. But it feels like that's been something that's been completely glossed over.
Remember when he came back in 6 months after...
And he looked good against Anthony Pettis. But Anthony Pettis hadn't had a meaningful win in a long time up until that point. I know he beat Wonderboy right after that fight, but still, that was Anthony Pettis kind of on his way out of the UFC. He was ranked 8th in the lightweight division at that time, so it wasn't still like people were thinking about Anthony Pettis as, oh, he could fight for the title at any day. It was a great fight by Ferguson, but I do feel like he has lost a step after that fight. And when you take into account the knee issues and just a lot of the damage he's eaten throughout his last few fights. I know it's been in different ways with Oliveira and Dariush than it was against Gaethje, but still, he was the nail much more than he was the hammer in those two fights too. And that's the hard thing. There's a real argument out there that Tony Ferguson's lost his last, what, 11 rounds? And that's just a really hard position to be going into a fight against Michael Chandler like that, because even Chandler in his losses has still looked pretty darn good.
Won the first round against Gaethje, gets dropped after that, rallies a little bit, like it... I have a hard time with this one because, again, for Ferguson to beat Chandler, could he go out there and submit Michael Chandler?
I don't think he can, honestly.
It's entirely possible. I don't see it happening. Could he go out there and rock Chandler? It's entirely possible.
Who is it who Chandler slammed, dislocated their arm, and immediately triangle choked?
My favorite guy, Brandon Gertz.
Okay, that's where I kind of disagree with you a little bit on Chandler's more position over submission. I think he can attack both in an equal manner. I do think his grappling is well-rounded enough to where, again, to predict he's going to submit Tony Ferguson is a crazy prediction. But I think he can handle his own in a lot of these grappling sequences on the mat. Again, I care way too much about Goichi Yamauchi, but guess what? He fights very similar to Tony Ferguson. Ferguson. They're both very back jujitsu oriented, and they're good rangy strikers. And Michael Chandler had a field day with Goiti, so I think he can do the same against Ferguson.
We definitely did see Christophe Jatko play that game last week against the people can't see it. Gerald Meerschaert, GM3, a prop from the show. But yeah, I have Michael Chandler in this matchup as well. Pains me to say it because everybody loves the Tony Ferguson fight. And I know we're probably going to get some hate in the comments section for not picking Tony Ferguson. But folks, let us know in the comments section who you have in this one.
Exactly. And if you do think Tony Ferguson is going to win, please try to set out a game plan. Because I'm very curious, what is Tony Ferguson's best path to victory? He's a great striker. He is really good on the ground. But again, Chandler just seems to have the counter for a lot of the strengths of Ferguson. So I'm curious where you guys think Ferguson can excel in this matchup.
Big time opportunity for both of these guys. We have two title fights up at the top between Namajunas and Esparza, Oliveira and Gaethje that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time fight for the strawweight title in a rematch, 2,703 days in the making. We have Rose Namajunas, Thug Rose, taking on the Cookie Monster, Carlos Esparza. I don't like the nickname the Cookie Monster. I don't like Cheesecake or Cupcake as nicknames either. Just, you know, don't go with that, please. But what I can say is that the waiting game paid off for Carlos
Esparza. Craig, no nickname Allen's talking a lot of jazz about other people's nicknames.
Maybe I should give myself a nickname. Like, listen, Slim
Reaper. Don't be Greg Hardy. You can't.
Slim Reaper's already out there. I could go with something like that. But when it comes to this fight coming up this weekend, for Esparza, she beats Yan Xiaonan. She shoots her shot for a title. Dana White goes, whoa, hold on now. And ultimately holding on now. Again, it did pay off. So that fight that she had against Yan Xiaonan, where she surprisingly won by finish, was 11 months ago. Before that, wins over Marina Rodriguez, the hotness in this division, Michelle Waterson, Alexa Grasso, and Vina Jandjidova. Big ones nonetheless. And for Esparza, very close fights in certain fights. Some fights, like her last one, she completely dominates and excels in. And a tough test against Rose Namajunas. We look at the 5-1 in, the fights that she's had against Joanna, the fight against Jessica Andrade, but then to beat Andrade the next time out, Zhang Weili to finish her, and then to win by split decision in her last fight. That last one against Zhang Weili was almost 6 months ago. So it's been a little bit of time since we've seen Rose Namajunas as well. But again, it's just crazy to think, because if you go back to their season of The Ultimate Fighter, that was the introduction of the strawweight division into the UFC. There were some big names like Alex Chambers, Jessica Penne, some big names. But the way that it was done was the UFC secretly seeded all of these fighters and the coaches didn't know about it. Carla Esparza was the number one seeded fighter. She was also the number one pick by Team Pettis. But if you look at it, she was the Invicta strawweight champ at that point.
100% justified. She did go on to win the title.
And she won the title, so exactly that. But it's just crazy to think that they were at that point. Rose Namajunas was, and I want to make sure that I get this one right, she was chosen with the fourth pick by Team Melendez. She was only 22 back then, and she's gone on to do such great things, but not a fighter that fights all that often. I mean, she's what, 12-4 if you count one of the three-round fights on The Ultimate Fighter, which we have up on the screen, 11-4 if you don't, but just a wild thing to go from, like, a fight on The Ultimate Fighter back in 2014 to rematching now, and both fighters still being at the top of their games too,
which has been really surprising. If you had told me after UFC 217, where Rose Namajunas won the title when she knocks out Joanna Jędrzejczyk, that Carla Esparza would ever make her way back to a title shot, I'd say that you probably haven't watched MMA in about 3 or 4 years, and I feel like I would have been right at that time to say so. Carla Esparza is like an S-tier Gerald Meerschaert, like an S-tier Paul Craig. And not the fact that they're jiu-jitsu oriented. They're very, very high-level problem solvers. And they figure out what their opponent's weakness is. And then they just find a way to exploit it. And that's why Esparza's wins, especially as of late, they've all been very close. Because Esparza's a really interesting fighter. She's extremely dominant on the ground. She is one of the best pure wrestlers in this division. Because Tatiana Suarez, I guess, doesn't fight in this division anymore. Don't worry, I'm going to talk about Tatiana here in a little bit. But Carla, to me, really is just, when you think about the premier wrestler at this weight division, you think about Carla Esparza. She knows what she's good at, and she knows what she isn't good at. And in this fight against Namajunas, Rose is the way better striker in this matchup. Can throw kicks, can throw in combination, has genuine power on the feet too to end this fight at any moment. Like, she's knocked down Jessica Andrade with a knee, head kicked Weili and knocked her out, and knocked out Joanna with a left hook. I think we can all agree Rose Namajunas has serious power, and it's wild. Like, You bring up what your nickname could be, Slim Reaper. If that was Rose Namajunas' nickname, no one would think twice about it, but she genuinely has incredible power for this division. It's just going to be weird for Esparza because, again, she always finds what her opponent's weakness is and she can exploit it. Against Marina Rodriguez, on the feet, Rodriguez looked phenomenal, but she couldn't get up off of the ground. Yan Xiaonan, on the feet, looked pretty good, but just couldn't deal with the pressure of Carla Esparza. Rose is one of those fighters who, on the feet, let's say these two are 50-50. Esparza at some point is going to have to shoot for a takedown, and no one at the UFC level up until this point has been able to solid prove to me that, hey, I can out-grapple Rose Namajunas, because it is kind of wild. We talk about her a lot with her striking on the feet now. She submitted a lot of fighters on her way up, and I always go back to the Michelle Waterson fight. That's when I really took notice of Rose Namajunas and thought, wow, she can be a world-class fighter in this division, because we talk about JSP when he fought Joe Lozon, how that was a bad loss. When Rose lost to Karolina Kovalkiewicz back at UFC 201, I know I'm going back for this, but I thought that was kind of it for her. I know it's a split decision. It was a really good fight, but I just felt like she was a step behind in that fight, and I never knew if we were going to see her rebuild back up to, you know, a title shot or even be top five. She went out and put on probably the most dominant performance of her career up until that point against Michelle Waterson. Head kicks her, gets her on the mat, chokes her with a rear naked choke, and from that moment on, I've kind of been able to see, okay, we know what the full package of Rose Namajunas is. I'm really excited for this rematch.
I mean, you look at it for Carla Esparza, longtime Southern California fighter, Team Oyama's own, and the bread and butter, or where the bread gets buttered, all of it. If we're hanging out at the bakery that is Team Oyama, it's Carla Esparza with her wrestling, with her grappling, with her top pressure, heavy, heavy upper body. And with Rose Namajunas, you talk about it when she's on the ground. She's such a slick back taker. She's so good at getting into the right position, not being too high, not getting bucked off, being able to do that. Now, when Zhang Wei Li made the move over to the States, Fight Ready MMA with Henry Cejudo and his weird pillows, they put the wrestling shoes on Zhang Wei Li, and she was able to gain the takedown on Rose Namajunas. Wasn't able to do much with them, and you can make an argument that she won that fight, lost that fight, whatever you want to do. I'm not here to have it today. But I will say that, listen, the game plan's there. The blueprint is there. Carla already has the win that's also there. There is an opportunity. Now, again, a 34 and a half, I guess. You don't really count half years when you're 34, but for somebody who's the Cookie Monster, maybe you do. When you look at it for Esparza, do you see it as a net positive being away for this long as to adding tools to your tool belt and getting that much better?
Not at this age. That's the problem. If she was a younger fighter in her career, and if she wasn't as set in her ways, maybe we would see a whole new added wrinkle. But to me, Carla Esparza doesn't do anything different now when she was, or from when she was champion. She just kind of does the things she did back then a little bit better now than she did back then. So I don't think we are going to see anything all that new from her. We just might see her wrestling finally be able to win out over the jiu-jitsu of Namajunas, because I know Esparza won their first fight by submission. I do not see that being the case whatsoever in this rematch. I think Namajunas on the mat is going to be tricky enough to where she's probably going to play the I'm going to go for broke, go for a lot of big sweeps. I might end up in a bit of a negative position to go for that really big sweep, because I don't think Esparza at this stage is going to threaten with as many submissions. We really haven't seen that out of her throughout this stage of her career, and this little wrench she's been able to go on, it's been a lot of full guard control, and that's good against some fighters, but Marina Rodriguez doesn't have a lot of attacks off of her back. She can't really make you pay for that. If you stay in the full guard of Rose Namajunas, she's going to threaten you with an armbar, a triangle choke, go for different sweeps and whatnot, and I do think that the maybe not inactivity, because Esparza did look really good her last time out against Yan Xiaonan from the top position. I think that fight's a bit of an outlier. We normally don't see that kind of an activity from Esparza in the top position. Normally she will be a little bit more positionally dominant over just trying to get off her own damage on the ground. And you're right, Wei Li may have set up the start of a game plan to take down Namajunas, but the difference is Wei Li can at least match Namajunas on the feet in some rounds of their fight, if not throughout a lot of their fight. I don't think Esparza is going to have a lot of success on the feet in this matchup.
Matt's saying that Esparza, from the start of her career to the point that she is now, she's kind of taken those skills and turned them up. One of those skills, standing against the cage looking pissed off as it gets, and just, yeah, she scares me. She scares me through the television. If they have that 4K thing on there where it blurs out the background, she's staring into my soul. It's like her eyes go black. She's like a demon. We look at the odds for this one. Demon Esparza opening plus 185, plus 165 right now. And for Namajunas, opens minus 220, minus 200 favorite. Having a look at the Tapology votes, Rose Namajunas has 2.5 million Instagram followers. I don't know where they came from, but they're there. I'm going to say they come out in full force, over under 85% Namajunas.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. Ooh, it's just slightly under. 795 total votes, 82%. Namajunas is 65% by decision. For the 18% that have Esparza, 78% by decision. I think Namajunas is going to get the win. I think she's better on the feet. I love Carla Esparza's last performance. And Matt, there used to be a talking point that we had about Carla Esparza. And I know I make fun of the mean mugging around the cage. Carla Esparza is somebody that we talked about on this channel for the longest time as a fighter that would always pick up just one little thing every fight. You'd see her do differently or a little bit better. Just one little change here or there. In her last fight, it was the ferociousness of the takedown and then getting in there and getting that finish to get her opportunity for a title fight. I'm eager to see, again, maybe an added wrinkle with that 11 months off. But again, to me, I look at Rose Namajunas, the sweeps, the submission abilities of her own. And then again, the fact that she's amplified that striking so much from the Ultimate Fighter season 20, Team Pettis and Melendez to now. I got to go with Rose Namajunas here.
Esparza just doesn't look comfortable on her feet. She never really has, if we're being completely honest. Like, go back and watch the Ioana and Jacek fight. That really shows how uncomfortable she looks on her feet. Now, that was earlier in her career. She has matured a lot since that performance. But there's never been a fight where Carla Esparza has gone out there and really dominated it with her stand-up. She really does need to implement her wrestling to win fights at this top level in the division. And I don't think taking down Rose Namajunas at this stage of her career is all that easy to do. And I think you're going to need a lot of damage on your way in for your entry. So I do like Namajunas in this matchup, but like you had said to start it off, it's really nice to see both these ladies still maintain their peak at the top of the sport, even after all this time and all these years since their first fight.
Both of us going with the and still in this matchup for Thug Rose Namajunas. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. Is it Thug Rose, Thug Rose, Thug Rose, or is it the Cookie Monster Carla Esparza from the Slim Reaper? Both of us going with, like I said, Thug Rose to get the win. And listen, you're not going to want to miss it because 2 hours before the prelims coming up this Saturday, Fighting Night Picks question mark kicks. If anybody missed weight, we have the opportunity to really go back and analyze that. So again, 2 hours before the prelims. And for this part of the card, the Fighting Night Picks sidekick, where we're hanging out here on the channel, opening up that chat, having the conversation with you folks out there. So make sure you tune into that. Keep it locked in with Fighting Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, an absolute banger for the lightweight title with the former interim champ, Justin Mr. Highlight. He is the highlight. He is Justin Gaethje taking on Charles Del Bronx Oliveira. And if you look at it, for Charles Oliveira, the recent run is absolutely amazing. It's legendary. He is in 6 all-time UFC categories in terms of, I don't know, total fights, wins, finishes, submission wins. He's in the top 10 of those categories. It's crazy to see. And for submissions, number 1 with 15. What about bonuses? Tied for number 1 with Cowboy Cerrone. 18 in the UFC. It's absolutely wild. You look at it. Takes on Michael Chandler, wins that belt, able to get it done. Takes on Dustin Poirier, finishes him with a crazy, crazy transition to get the submission. Charles Oliveira, he's like Hansel. He's so hot right now. And he's taking on Justin Gaethje. The commenters in our YouTube community tab, they don't have nice things to say about him. But to you YouTube community tab commenters out there, former World Series of Fighting champ. When he started his career off, he was a wrestler that would slam guys and knock them out.
Ask Kevin Kroom how it went.
Poor, poor Kevin Kroom. But if you look at it for Justin Gaethje in the UFC, 6-3, he's won a bonus in every fight but one, where he got bonused when he took on Habib. Habib got a performance bonus. Gaethje has 10 in the other 8 fights. Performance and fight of the night against Michael Johnson. He's got a performance and a fight of the night against Tony Ferguson. And if you look at it for Justin Gaethje, loses to Habib, beats Michael Chandler in a fight of the year. Oh, but how many fight of the years has Justin Gaethje had since he came into the UFC in 2017, Craig? He's had three. Michael Johnson, Dustin Poirier, and Michael Chandler. So it's been an amazing run for Justin Gaethje, and I think this is an amazing fight coming up this weekend.
I was just about to say, he's got a pretty good chance to make it 4-for-4 this weekend, because this matchup against Charles Oliveira is everything MMA fans like. And I go a few different directions with this, but this is what I'm going to start off with. Fighting Charles Oliveira is like holding the water back from a dam. You have to be very, very structurally sound and follow a really, really smart game plan to be able to beat him. Because if you're fighting someone like Oliveira, the second any water gets through that dam, you know there's a big wall of it coming from behind. And Gaethje, with his grappling, he's weird. And when you break down grappling, you have to break it down into two parts. You have wrestling and you have jiu-jitsu. Both are considered grappling, but they are both very different. Justin Gaethje is a pretty good defensive wrestler. I know they talked about it a lot in the lead up to the Khabib fight, and we didn't really see it in that matchup. But again, Gaethje does have a very, very high level of wrestling in his back pocket that you can always go to. And this fight, I think, is very similar to the Dustin Poirier fight. Because on the feet, Poirier and Gaethje, they're pretty similar. I would say Gaethje might hit a little bit harder, but Poirier's probably a little bit more technical with his boxing. The difference is, I think Poirier is a far better jiu-jitsu player than Justin Gaethje is. I know he gets submitted by Charles Oliveira, but Dustin Poirier himself is a very, very high-level grappler. Whereas the second we saw Justin Gaethje on the mat with Khabib, and I know we're comparing him against one of the greatest grapplers we've ever seen, but Poirier was able to at least maintain some positions, have a little bit of success with Khabib. And again, not a whole lot, but he had him in a guillotine. He was able to get back his guard a couple times. The second Gaethje was on his back, he kind of looked like a fish out of water against Khabib. And I'm pretty sure Charles Oliveira, if he's watching that fight at home, he's thinking, okay, well, like, I might not be the same wrestler as Khabib Nurmagomedov, but the second the fight hits the ground, Oliveira might be one of the few fighters who could maybe challenge Khabib in the grappling. I know that's a crazy thing to say, but like, Charles Oliveira is at that level of grappling in the UFC. He's been able to demonstrate it time and time again. And the really nice thing about Oliveira too, he's someone who people used to question, oh, does he have heart? Is he someone who could quit? He did kind of quit against Paul Felder. Let's be 100% honest, he did. But my favorite boxer of all time is Roberto Duran. He quit in a fight too, but you know what he did after that? Went on to win a world championship again. Like, he had some really strong moments later on in his life, even though he had a weak moment at one point. Charles Oliveira is in the exact same category. Did he have a weak moment in the cage? Maybe. You know what he's done ever since? Eaten massive shots, faced a lot of adversity, and come out the other end looking better. And I think that's probably the biggest evolution Charles Oliveira has made throughout his career. Yes, he's been able to match the striking with his grappling, but just his overall level of maturity now. Like, you hear about him talk, it's not about me, it's about us as a gym. It's about how can I not only make me better, but everybody else who I'm with. And I just feel like we're seeing a level of maturity out of Charles Oliveira. It's just like that championship confidence. It's something you hear about a lot. Well, Charles Oliveira definitely has it ever since he's been able to get that UFC belt.
It'll be interesting to see if he falls again, where that goes, because we've seen some fighters where they keep the team around. We've seen some fighters where they go, okay, remember that game plan, like Deiveson Figueiredo, I'm going to Fight Ready MMA, forget about everything that I was doing in Brazil. So for Charles Oliveira, really, really repping that gym strong. Diego Lima, the old Shoot the Box. And you look at it over in our YouTube community section, Matt. So we threw out the poll earlier on today. 792 total votes, 68% going with Charles Oliveira. Your comments are appreciated. Bob said I got Charles winning because of how non-existent Justin's BJJ is. Hopefully I will say I am worried at how Charles handles the low kicks. In all reality, this fight is dictated by who pressures the other to the cage. Both guys get hurt when their backs are to the cage. We've also got Slim saying, I think Gaethje knocks him out. We've got Scott saying Gaethje will easily beat him in the first round. Only casual fanboy would say different. Matt, I don't know about that. But realistically, you look at this fight, and for Justin Gaethje, he has a fight of the night against Edson Barboza that was over at the 2.5 minute mark of round number one.
It was a wild 2.5 minutes, though.
That's absolutely wild. For Gaethje, though, the thing that I love about him is you can have a 2.5 minute fight of the night against Edson Barboza, or you can have a fight that goes long where you finish Tony Ferguson, where he was still on his crazy win streak. He's still technically unbeatable at that point. Where Gaethje picked away at him, and between rounds three and four, Trevor Whitman's going, okay, you got to start to implement the left hook into this one. You got to start working the leg kick. And you see Justin Gaethje following that game plan to a T, making those adjustments and showing people at home that he's not just a brawler, but people don't believe that even in 2022. So yes, there are some aspects of his game where he looks like Homer Simpson with a crayon in his brain. But there's other aspects where you sit back, you watch the fight, you analyze it, and you realize this guy can make technical mid-fight adjustments to where he wins.
He still gets cracked like it's going out of style, though.
Oh, yeah. But again, offensively, we can see him make some of these adjustments. And again, we've seen these losses in the UFC because he was undefeated coming in. He has the Ultimate Fighter, the Michael Johnson. He loses to Eddie Alvarez, loses to Poirier, loses to Khabib Nurmagomedov. I know Eddie Alvarez on a rough run right now.
Three of the greatest lightweights of all time.
Though. I know Eddie Alvarez on a rough run right now, but trust me, he is a great. Dustin Poirier is a great. Habib is the great. BJ Penn is also a great, but you might not like me saying that.
And Charles Oliveira is well on his way to becoming one of those greats, and I feel like people need to start realizing that. Like, right now, I feel like everybody kind of widely agrees that Kamaru Usman's the closest out of any current champion to potentially getting the GOAT category in his division. And trust me, we love GSP. We're Canadians. But even we have to come to that realization eventually where it's like, okay, Usman's beaten everybody in the top five. He looks incredibly dominant while he's doing it. Like, you're getting towards that GOAT conversation. Charles Oliveira faces adversity in his fights, but also finishes all of them. And that's the really incredible thing about Charles Oliveira. He can knock you out. He can submit you. He can win by decision. Whatever you need, Charles Oliveira's got it. And the thing about this fight is, I think the ranges are going to be really weird. Because in your mind, you probably think, okay, at long distance, Oliveira's going to have success. He likes that straight right. He works behind the jab. A little bit more kick-heavy than Justin Gaethje. But I think the leg kicks of Gaethje are enough of an X factor to where Oliveira's going to have a hard time at kickboxing range. The flip side is, if you watch the Oliveira versus Poirier fight, he struggles at boxing range with Poirier. But when he decides to smother the boxing range and make it kind of dirty boxing, more clinch work, Oliveira lights him on fire. He's throwing elbows in tight, knees to the body, uppercuts up the middle too. And these are techniques that have a lot of power behind them because Oliveira's in that category. If you look at him and you think, wow, he probably doesn't hit very hard, you couldn't be more wrong. He has a really nice pop on the end of his shots. And that's why I do like Oliveira in this fight. I think there's a world out there where Oliveira TKOs Justin Gaethje. There's a world out there where he submits Gaethje. And there's a world out there where he beats him by decision too. I could see Gaethje winning by knockout, but I think he's going to have a really hard time putting 25 minutes of success together because Oliveira is so multifaceted. Against Tony Ferguson, you can go out there and just strike with him. But Oliveira proved he's a way better wrestler than Tony Ferguson is. He has those really nice body-to-body takedowns too, and that's the last X factor I'll bring up. Oliveira is a good wrestler, and he doesn't do it in a traditional sense. He likes clinch takedowns and body-to-body takedowns. Those are takedowns that I do think Gaethje could struggle with because they aren't as traditional as what he's used to. And again, that's why I like Oliveira in this fight, but this is an awesome one.
Charles Oliveira could win a fight in any which way. Justin Gaethje, though, to give you the flip side and the argument there, too, I would be damn surprised if Justin Gaethje goes out there and Anthony Hernandez is Rodolfo Vieira and submits Charles Oliveira.
Well, of course he's not going to submit.
That would be absolutely insane. But for Gaethje, craziest part about it is, you know, you look at just numbers on a page, he is at a reach disadvantage when it comes to the striking. You had mentioned it, the right hand of Charles Oliveira, but Justin Gaethje has some of the best leg kicks in MMA, so that really cuts things down. That opens up a window to his boxing. We know how good Justin Gaethje's boxing is. And then in comes those mid-fight adjustments, the adjustments to, okay, I'm going to start throwing that left hook. I'm going to start countering a little bit less, being a little bit more offensive with some of my movements, can definitely cause Charles Oliveira some issues. Now, we look at this fight in terms of the odds. You look at it for Oliveira, open to minus 205, favorite minus 170 right now. Justin Gaethje, open to plus 175, plus 140. Again, we already talked about the votes in that YouTube community tab. I'm going to update them right now so we can get a little bit more of a live look at them. 803 total votes, still at 68% Oliveira. The fans are going with Oliveira. The price is dropping on Oliveira. I mean, I like that.
Oliveira reminds me of Fernando Tatis Jr. Hear me out. Baseball is a sport that's dominated by skills, not athleticism. If you're very skilled, you'll make it very, very far. But if you have both, and you can put both together, you can be something really special. To me, if Charles Oliveira wasn't a really good athlete, still, everything he does technically is extremely high level. Then you give him his level of athleticism, the speed, the power that he has. It just puts him over the edge, and that's why I like Oliveira in this fight.
Yeah, it really is a tricky fight when you're trying to break it down. I know, again, if we're not picking Justin Gaethje.
Couple of casuals,
and I guess that might be what we are. But Matt, I do have Charles Oliveira in this matchup. I want to hear from you down below in the comment section. I want to hear from you on Apple Podcasts. I want to hear from you on Spotify, even though they don't really have a comment section there. They should. Google Podcasts, wherever you get the podcast, there's a version of this in the audio form. And if you can't find it there, go to FightNightPicks.com, the website. Joshua Hart doing the damn thing over there. But all of the podcasts, the full card betting guides that he puts together, they are available on the website. You can hang out with us
2 hours before the prelims for Fight Night Picks, question mark kicks, and then we also have the sidekick, Matt. What is the sidekick?
The sidekick, you've probably heard of these fight companions before. They're fun and all that. They're not the Fight Night Picks sidekick, though. It's just our chance to go over. We do our own commentary, have a lot of fun with you guys watching the fights. That's really what it's all about at the end of the day. Just watching MMA with more people who love the same sport we do. So hopefully you check it out, because here's the thing. We have some pay-per-views where, listen, there might be one fight on the main card where you have to get some maybe fake enthusiasm about. This couldn't be further from the truth. I am as excited for Cowboy Cerrone versus Joe Lozon as I am for Justin Gaethje versus Charles Oliveira. But I still think this whole main card is going to be incredible.
I can't wait for Shogun Hua to walk out to the Naked and the Famous.
And he just starts crying.
Oh, it's going to be something. Make sure you tune in for all of that great stuff. Thank you so much for tuning in. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.